that punk defined and influenced their lives. A People's History of Punk starts tomorrow afternoon at 4 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 19th of January. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster.
The headlines today, Sir Keir Starmer is to lay out his response to President Trump's threat to impose tariffs on the UK and other European countries over Greenland as the EU considers how it could retaliate. At least 21 people have died after two high-speed trains collided in southern Spain.
Also on today's programme, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns about brazen violations of international law, including by Donald Trump's America.
This is what we are witnessing, the sense that anyone can do whatever they want because nothing will happen to them. We see military expenditures growing exponentially, but humanitarian aid diminishing tragically.
We'll ask him whether the global order is breaking apart and if the UN can still hold it together. Is the government preparing to ban social media for under-16s? A former education minister will tell us why she thinks it's now ready to act. And punk at 50. Half a century on, how the movement blew apart British culture and changed the world. Before all of that, the BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
Sir Keir Starmer is to make a statement in Downing Street this morning to outline the government's response to President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on countries opposing his takeover of Greenland. The Prime Minister has already spoken on the phone to Mr. Trump, saying it's wrong to target NATO allies in this way. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
Government sources say Sir Keir is holding the hastily arranged news conference because he believes voters, and in particular businesses, need to understand how his government plans to respond to the possibility of 10% tariffs in less than a fortnight. The Prime Minister is expected to reiterate today what he told Donald Trump in a phone call yesterday, that applying tariffs on allies for pursuing the collective security of NATO is completely wrong. Opposition parties have been united in condemning the White House's threat. The Liberal Democrats have gone further than most in calling for retaliatory tariffs and other measures which they say will hit Trump and his cronies where it hurts. President Trump is taking a large US delegation to the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos this week. Sir Keir is not currently planning to attend, but Number 10 sources have said it is possible that could change.
The European Union says it will make intense efforts to dissuade Mr. Trump from going ahead with the tariffs, but at the same time, its members are working on possible retaliatory measures. One option is to impose tariffs worth more than 90 billion euros on US products. Another is to restrict access to the European single market. EU leaders are to hold an emergency summit in Brussels on Thursday. The UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has told this programme that changes need to be made to the Security Council. He says a body that was created after the Second World War no longer represents the world that exists now. The power to veto resolutions should be limited, he said, and the composition of the Council changed to help regain its legitimacy. In the interview, Mr. Guterres also accuses the US of exercising power outside the norms of international law.
There are those that believe that the power of law should be replaced by the law of power. And indeed, when one sees the present policy of the United States, there is a clear conviction that multilateral solutions are not relevant, and that what matters is the exercise of the power and the influence of the United States.
At least 21 people have been killed in a collision between two high-speed trains in southern Spain. The crash happened outside the town of Adamuz near Cordoba. More than 30 people are being treated for serious injuries in hospital. One government minister has described what happened as extremely strange, given it was on a straight section of track, which had been revamped last year. Reporting from Madrid, Guy Hedgeco.
One of the trains was travelling from Malaga in the south to Madrid's Atocha station when it derailed about an hour into its journey, colliding with another train travelling in the opposite direction. According to local authorities, there were victims on both. A firefighter said retrieving people from the wreckage was difficult as the carriages were twisted, so the metal was twisted with the people inside. One witness said that one carriage had completely overturned. Rafael Moreno, the mayor of Adamuth, who reached the scene soon after the accident, described it as like a nightmare.
Official figures show China's economy grew by 5% last year, meeting the target set by the country's President Xi Jinping. According to the data, China also experienced its lowest birth rate on record in 2025. An international trial is underway to see if the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease can be detected using a simple finger prick blood test rather than expensive brain scans. The study involves 1,000 volunteers across the UK, Canada and US. Our medical editor Fergus Walsh has more.
Diagnosing Alzheimer's from a blood sample is a technology that is rapidly coming of age. It analyses so-called blood-based biomarkers, which show the presence of rogue proteins in the brain that can accumulate 15 years before the first symptoms of the disease are seen. The finger prick test involves just a few drops of blood and could potentially be done at home and posted to a clinic for analysis. The study is being led by the medical research charity LifeArc, which said if successful, it could lead to a cost-effective screening program for Alzheimer's.
Reform UK has called the former Shadow Minister Andrew Rosendale a great addition to the party after his defection last night from the Conservatives. Mr. Rosendale, who represents Romford in East London, said the views of his constituents had been consistently ignored for far too long. Reform now has 7 MPs in the Commons. The Shadow Welsh Secretary, Mims Davies, told the Westminster Hour on Radio 4 that Nigel Farage's party was completely self-serving.
The bottom line is there is already infighting in the Gang of Seven. At least now they can sit in the back of a, you know, 7-seater, and good luck to them. We've got the job to do, the official opposition, and we take it seriously.
In football, Senegal are celebrating winning the Africa Cup of Nations after a 1-0 victory against Morocco. A dramatic end to the final saw the game's only goal scored in the 4th minute of extra time. But as John Bennett reports from the Moroccan capital Rabat, the match will be remembered for much more.
A game which will go down as one of the most controversial finals in major tournament history. In injury time, the referee awarded host Morocco a penalty after being told to check the VAR screen, and this led to chaotic scenes. Some Senegal fans tried to get onto the pitch, and the Senegal coach tried to usher his team off the field in protest. When play got underway 16 minutes later, Morocco star Brahim Diaz wasted the chance to win the title by attempting a tame Panenka penalty, which was saved, and Senegal went on to win the trophy in extra time.
That was John Bennett in Rabat.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. The time is 7 minutes past six, and we're going to get our first look at the weather with Sarah Keith Lucas. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Emil. Things are pretty misty and murky out there, quite damp for many of us today. It's going to turn increasingly wet and windy through the middle part of this week, though. But today, very different weather conditions across different parts of the UK. Let's start in the far west, where we've got a slow-moving weather front. So if you're across Northern Ireland, as well as the Western Isles and the far southwest of England, particularly the Isles of Scilly into the west of Cornwall, here on and off outbreaks of rain through the day. It is going to be cloudy and it's going to be wet. We've also got a bit of rain today for parts of central England. So across northern England, down into the Midlands, into central southern England, expect some patchy, fairly light rain. Quite a lot of low cloud and hill fog lingering too. But away from these areas, there should be a little bit of sunshine coming through. So for much of southwest England, into Wales, much of Scotland away from the far west, cold start to the day, but there'll be some sunshine developing later on. And the mist that we've got this morning and the fog patches that are locally dense will slowly clear away. Also, the far southeast of England and East Anglia, one or two showers this morning, but tending to brighten up into the afternoon. Now, temperatures today will range between around about 5 to 11 degrees north to south. Overnight tonight, there'll be quite a bit of cloud, some outbreaks of patchy light rain moving towards the north and the east. Touch of frost around in the west overnight tonight, but do expect some strong winds and heavy rain to arrive in the southwest by tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Sarah. It's 9 minutes past six. Let's take a first look at the front pages of the morning papers. And fears Trump's tariffs threat will tear NATO apart is how the Daily Express lays bare the divisions surrounding that plan by the US president to take over Greenland. The Daily Mail says the Prime Minister delivered an unprecedented rebuke to Mr. Trump when he told him that applying tariffs to NATO allies was wrong.
The Times says Sir Keir Starmer is opting to take a damage limitation approach in the hope that a carve-out from the tariffs can be negotiated, as was the case last year when the US unveiled sweeping trade levies. The Eye suggests the challenge facing the Prime Minister is stark, saying he is in an 11th hour scramble to save the UK-US relationship.
Blackmail is the accusation levelled at President Trump in the Daily Mirror's headline. The paper quotes the call by the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, for the government to cancel the King's state visit to the US in April. He says the UK must not be a doormat for an extortionist. The Daily Star's editorial agrees with that, suggesting publicly bruising Trump's ego might be the best way to get the US president to take a step back and think.
The Eye reports that water company bosses could be fined from their own pockets for issues such as sewage spills under a new industry regulator. A white paper that sets out plans to reform regulation of the sector will be published by ministers this week. The Environment Secretary, Emma Reynolds, tells The Eye that bosses will have nowhere to hide.
We'll talk more about that before 7 o'clock this morning. And the Daily Telegraph describes Andrew Rosendale's defection from the Conservatives to Reform UK as a major blow to Kemi Badenoch. The paper says he is the fourth sitting MP to make the move after Lee Anderson, Danny Kruger and Robert Jenrick. The Daily Mail points out that Mr. Rosendale's defection will renew claims that Reform is home to too many Tories and is not seen as a radical new movement.
Indeed. Time now is 10 past six. Let's turn to events in Spain, because it does look like this high-speed train derailing, smashing into another oncoming train in southern Spain last night, has killed at least 21 people. It looks like early reports are suggesting that people from both trains were killed. The Prime Minister in Spain has called it a night of deep pain. Guy Hedgeco is our correspondent in Madrid. Guy, good morning from London. Just tell us what we know about what happened. The pictures look absolutely dreadful.
Yes, good morning, Amal. Well, we know that one of these trains was travelling from Malaga in the south of the country, heading up towards Madrid. It was about an hour into its journey last night, at about 8:15, when some of its rear carriages seemed to have derailed, and those carriages collided with an oncoming train that was heading in the opposite direction from Madrid down to the south of the country, knocking that train off its rails and down a slope. As you mentioned there, we've been told that there were victims in both of the trains. And overnight, rescue services have been working really throughout the night, pulling survivors out of both wrecks. One of them in particular was extremely difficult to get to. The trains were twisted in some cases, some of the carriages, some of them were turned right over. So it's been a very difficult task for the rescue authorities.
And just looking at some of the reports on social media, Guy, there's this desperate fact, not only that the death toll is rising, may continue to rise, of course, but also families desperate to find out what's happened to their loved ones, and lots of them still lacking clear information.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that's partly because where this accident took place, this town called Adamuth, it's just a tiny little town in Andalusia. It's not a big town or near a large city, so it's quite a sort of secluded area. That has made both the rescue efforts difficult and also made things much more difficult for people wanting to know what's going on. We know that around 70 people are still in hospital. They're either in Cordoba or Jaén hospitals nearby. But the authorities have set up a helpline to try and help families contact their loved ones. And there have been buses taking people back and forth from the site. But there is still a lot of confusion there. And the head of Renfe, which is the national rail operator, said in the early hours of the morning that we still don't know the full scale of what happened. So there's still a certain amount of confusion there.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid, thank you.
It is 13 minutes past six now. The government's abandoned the third reading of the so-called Hillsborough Law after pressure from campaigners to stop the security services from being excluded from elements of it. Daniel De Simone is our correspondent who's been following this story. Daniel, remind us first of all, before we talk about what the potential impact of that might be, what it was that campaigners were unhappy about.
Well, campaigners were concerned that the government's version of proposed bill would effectively give too much power to the security services, intelligence services, so MI5 and MI6, and that the law wouldn't fully apply to individual officers who were working for them. Other organisations, for example, the police and government departments, the full duty of candour would apply to them, to individual public officials. But there was a real concern that MI5 and MI6 officers would be effectively exempt. And then the proposed amendment that was due to be voted on today, campaigners were concerned that that amendment would give too much power to the heads of those services to give permission to their staff to comply with the duty, which meant when they're giving evidence to, for example, inquests and public inquiries.
And as I was saying, you've been following this story, you've been describing the process as it's been going on, and now it looks like we might see this change.
Well, the government really at a very late stage has abandoned the entire third reading of the bill, which was due to take place today. Behind the scenes, officials have been insisting that the third reading would go ahead, that there would be votes on these amendments the government proposed relating to the intelligence services. And that was due to happen today. Then late yesterday, first of all, they were not going to have a vote on the amendment. And then they pulled the entire third reading. And this is really because there's a brewing rebellion effectively taking place by around 30 Labour MPs who are not going to support the government's amendment. We're going to support an amendment by the Labour MP Ian Byrne, who works with the Hillsborough Law Now campaign group. So this was becoming a real problem for the government. This policy was really a flagship policy for the Prime Minister. He'd very much associated himself with Hillsborough Law Now and the bereaved families. So the fact this has developed into a really serious dispute over the extent to which it will apply to the intelligence services is like a real test of the Prime Minister's authority. At the moment, we don't know now when this third reading is going to happen, when the final common stage will take place. The government saying they're going to work with all parties to strengthen the bill, but campaigners saying that they're not going to accept anything less than a law that the bereaved families are happy with.
Daniel, thank you very much.
It is 16 minutes past six, and here in the flesh in the studio, it's the great Will Bain with the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Amol. Yes, not so great for trade relationships around the world this morning, as you were touching on in the newspapers there as well. Europe and the United States in particular seem to be in meltdown after President Trump threatened eight countries, including the UK, with additional tariffs on imports unless the US is allowed to take control of Greenland. They would come into force on exports to the United States from February the 1st, with the White House saying if it doesn't get what it wants in terms of Greenland, then those tariffs could be ramped up to an additional 25%. Richard Rumblow is with us, the Director of International Business at Make UK, represents UK manufacturers. Richard, morning.
Morning, Will.
First of all, just going back a step before your kind of sort of reaction of the potential impact here, would these be 10% on top of the blanket sort of 10% that was negotiated in that deal with President Trump last year, and as a result, 10% say on top of the 25% that we've got for steel and aluminium as well? Are these additional tariffs, I guess, is what I'm getting at?
I think it's difficult to judge at this point. We're still waiting for any legal confirmation from the US administration about precisely what the tariffs would be and precisely how they would be applied and what products could or could not be in scope. So it's difficult to make that judgment at this point. Certainly, if you look at the general tone of it, it would seem to be applying an additional 10% on that 10% which came into effect from April last year and could miss out on products which are under other tariff treatments by the US administration, principally steel derivatives, and the UK automotive sector. The other point to bear in mind here as well is that we are expecting a Supreme Court judgment this week or maybe next, which will rule on the legality of those localised tariffs which were introduced as reciprocal tariffs in April of last year. So we could be in a situation where those 10% tariffs under that are deemed to be illegal, but suddenly you're facing a reinstatement of 10% should this come through as announced over the weekend.
Right. And so reaction from your members then through the weekend so far from what they can make out of it so far?
I mean, boardrooms are going to be concerned as they meet on Monday morning and during the course of this week. This just adds additional uncertainty to what has been a difficult time in terms of trade with the US, maintaining those important customer relations in an important market, which is the US for UK manufacturing. So it just adds that continued uncertainty, which is particularly poignant at this particular time. So companies will be assessing what this could mean for them. They'll be contacting their US customers, seeing what their reaction is, working with their freight forwarders and other logistics firms to see what the practicalities of this is. But again, another point to make here is the 1st of February is a matter of weeks away. It takes longer than that for a product to leave UK shores and to reach US shores. So if you have a product that's already in transit or is potentially in transit from this week going to the US, it could be that those products will face tariffs from the 1st of February as soon as they land on US soil.
And we saw our biggest exporters last time with that kind of uncertainty around, Richard, didn't we? The ones that could afford to press pause on doing that, thinking of JLR and others pausing their exports to the US for a period while they tried to work out what was going on with tariffs. Presumably, if that happens again, regardless of whether these tariffs come into force, that could have a massive impact down the supply chain of these companies once again.
Firms will be making that assessment from this week. What is it that they need to do to maintain the flow of products into the US, to maintain those important relationships, but also to balance their production capability as well? So it is going to be that internal process of assessment over the course of the coming days and weeks, subject to confirmation that these tariffs will come into effect. What I think is really important... No, I was just going to say, I think what's really important here at this point is we have effective trade diplomacy from the UK. I don't think this is a time for an immediate retaliatory action against the US. We have a progressive conversation with them through the economic partnership deal, which was the trade framework announced in the spring of last year. There is still some way to go. We have seen movement through that, which has benefited firms from the peaks of the tariff announcements last spring. So, for example, on UK automotives, it's 10% compared to much higher rates for other countries. We've seen the recent pharmacy framework agreement, which will be zero tariffs for them. And also we have seen a progression of positive bits coming into the UK manufacturing sector as a result of that importance of trade diplomacy. It is time for cool heads.
At what point, though, Richard, does all this uncertainty actually just become too much of a headache, that it outweighs those benefits, and then actually it's time for companies to start reassessing supply chains, perhaps even markets?
Our initial data is beginning to suggest that sort of concern is beginning to wash on decisions about how attractive the US is for manufacturers. I think they are beginning to make that assessment.
What, and the people are pulling back investment?
Beginning to pull back, beginning to assess that. I think that has been a progressive thing over the course of the last 9 months since April of last year, and in fact slightly before then. So I think you're beginning to see some of that beginning to affect decisions about the attractiveness that is leading from the uncertainty of tariffs.
Richard Rumblow, Director of International Business at Make UK, thanks so much for your time. Well, Olivia Micklem is with us this morning as well. Olivia is the fund manager at Artemis Funds. Morning.
Good morning, Will.
How are the futures markets looking then? What are investors making of all of this through the weekend?
Yeah, well, you know, unsurprisingly, futures are down right now. Slight added wrinkle to the dynamic is that the US market is shut today for a bank holiday. So, you know, who knows what headlines may come through over the course of today that could change the outcome of how the market in the US opens tomorrow. But, you know, understandably, these kind of headlines create volatility. Now, that being said, as we saw after Liberation Day in April of last year, equity markets recovered in a pretty robust fashion. So, you know, as various tariff headlines initially got worse and then got rolled back, you know, the market sort of started to realise that they could look through some of these issues. Businesses were able to work out how to adapt supply chains, you know, some of the changes that Richard talked about that get considered. So we'll see. You know, I think you do tend to get a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. So it would be no surprise to see a little bit of softness today. But until we really know the actual kind of validity of these headlines, you know, what is actually going to happen, what is legally able to happen, it'll take some time. for the market to want to digest those facts before they really price anything in for good.
Just beyond those manufacturers that Richard represents as well, though, presumably companies to watch out for when the market does open here in the UK, pharmaceutical companies, chemicals companies, companies like Diageo, I guess, exporting booze and things like that.
Yeah, quite possibly. You know, I think they're big part. The US is a big market for those businesses, right? So pulling out of them completely certainly doesn't seem like it's exactly possible. So that will be a question, and we will likely to see more pressure on some of those exporters that have a big exposure to the US. Now, that being said, on the other side of the equation, if you think about something like the pharmaceutical companies, it's not been that long since some of them have been signing specific deals with Trump and his administration around most favored nation pricing that has allowed them to have some exemptions from some of the tariffs. So how that factors in to these headlines remains to be seen.
And bonds presumably as well to be watched too.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think the bond market reaction is probably the one that the administration is likely to watch most closely. You know, the risk of this causing more inflation in the US is potential, right? And certainly the administration has been hyper-focused on trying to improve affordability as they head towards the midterms. You know, higher inflation and what that might do to the scope for rate cuts from here is really important. So the bond market, I think, will tell the administration what they need to communicate pretty quickly if they need to.
Olivia Micklem, fund manager at Artemis Funds, thanks so much for your time. Well, the World Economic Forum in the Swiss ski resort of Davos kicks off today under the guidance of new leadership, including the chief exec of one of the world's biggest investment management firms, BlackRock's Larry Fink. The slightly beleaguered meeting of the world's leading politicians and business leaders were hoping that this year was going to be something of a reboot, but with President Trump and a huge US delegation set to attend, could Davos now be overshadowed by this row over Greenland and new tariffs? Marco Amitrano is with a senior partner at PwC UK, who joins us from Davos. Marco, morning.
Morning, Will.
Has that sort of overtaken all the conversations on this first morning then?
No, look, I think things are ramping up here in Davos. It was busy already last night, which you know, seems more than in recent years. And I think there's a lot of anticipation. Your last few guests, if you like, have illustrated, you know, the level of uncertainty. And I think everyone's looking forward to productive dialogue this week. It's the biggest showing of heads of state, I think, since the 70s, 65 heads of state coming here, pretty much the head of every global business. So, you know, lots could happen this week. I think this is actually, for the first time in many, many years, the centre of the universe again.
Interesting. Does it change the type of conversations you'll be wanting to have with people, though, and the clarity that you're seeking?
Yeah, look, I mean, PwC and many like us are here for important reasons to help our clients understand what all this means, the interdependencies from geopolitics to technology to climate change. You know, I mean, the level of uncertainty is as high as I've ever known it to be. And actually, clients need to understand scenarios and optionality. There is no one pathway forward anymore.
And beyond the chat around tariffs, what other conversations will you be having?
Well, look, AI is just incredibly dominant here this week. I mean, there's tariffs into geopolitics, of course, and the movement of capital, who has it, where they want to deploy it, and why. And a cross-cutting theme is data, technology, still cloud, but AI, and potentially moving on towards quantum, which is not in the not-too-distant future.
So more than just a cocktail party in the snow this week, then?
Yeah, much more than just a cocktail party in the snow, yeah.
Marco Amitrano, a senior partner at PwC UK, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. It's 27 minutes past six now. It's time for the sport. Morning, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Let's go to some live sport this morning. It's day two of the Australian Open. The British number three, Jacob Fernley, is on court at the moment, aiming to join Emma Raducanu, Cam Norrie and Arthur Ferry, who progressed to the second round yesterday. Let's go across to Melbourne. And the BBC's tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller. Russell, how is Fernley getting on?
He has dropped the first set on a tiebreak by 7-2 to the Polish player Kamil Majszrak. He's been struggling with his serve in recent months, and there were indeed five double faults in that first set from Fernley. Going with serve in the second set for the moment at five games all. The other British player in action today was Fran Jones, who was forced to retire from the Australian Open once again when trailing the qualifier Linda Klimovicheva 6-3, 3-2 and a break. She had injured her right leg when she played in the first week of the season in Auckland, and the injury was exacerbated by a fall early in the match today. She plays with the EED condition, which means she has three fingers and a thumb on each hand, three toes on her right foot and four toes on her left. And that does mean that she is very prone to injuries and has suffered from a number of retirements throughout her career.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary player, isn't she? Thank you very much, Russell. And the Tennis Breakfast team are over on Five Sports Extra. There was a chaotic end to the Africa Cup of Nations final, which was eventually won by Senegal, but not before they caused a long delay by walking off the pitch and temporarily refusing to play after Morocco were awarded a stoppage time penalty. Senegal beat Morocco 1-0 to lift the trophy for the second time. John Bennett has the details.
A game which will go down as one of the most controversial finals in major tournament history. In injury time, the referee awarded host Morocco a penalty after being told to check the VAR screen, and this led to chaotic scenes. Some Senegal fans tried to get onto the pitch, and the Senegal coach tried to usher his team off the field in protest. When play got underway 16 minutes later, Morocco star Brahim Diaz wasted the chance to win the title by attempting a tame Panenka penalty, which was saved, and Senegal went on to win the trophy in extra time.
Aston Villa missed a chance to move into second place in the Premier League after a 1-0 defeat to Everton. Wolves and Newcastle United drew 0-0. Celtic and Aberdeen are into the Scottish Cup last 16, and Liverpool, Manchester City and Manchester United are all through to the fifth round of the Women's FA Cup. All of the weekend's results are on the BBC Sport website. A few other sporting headlines for you this morning, and Bath will host Saracens in the last 16 of Rugby Union's European Champions Cup. Harlequin's reward for yesterday's 27-17 win over La Rochelle is a home tie against Sale Sharks, and Leicester will face top seed Bordeaux. Kyron Wilson won his first Masters snooker title, beating John Higgins by 10 frames to 6. And the reigning Sale GP champions Emirates GBR have won the first race of the 2026 season in Perth. Now, later in the programme, we'll hear from the British tennis number 2, Sonia Cartel, who plays her first round match at the Australian Open tonight, but her dad might not be watching.
He came to Wimbledon last year, which was a first. He managed to stay through every single one of my matches, which was something that's never, he's never been able to master. Even at home, he's kind of pacing up and down the house, shouting to my mum in another room, you know, what's the score? What's going on? Because sometimes he can't watch either.
Cartel is a pretty different tennis player in background and in technique, and we'll hear more from her at 8:25.
Carthy, thank you very much indeed. This week on Radio 4, a faceless hacker and a shocking data breach.
How would it feel to have your deepest secrets held to ransom?
You have different tragedies in your life that you wouldn't write even into your own journal.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and this is the story of an unprecedented crime.
Very different from anything so far.
What made it different?
The amount of suffering.
Thousands of victims exposed by a huge data hack and the hunt to track down a criminal who was thought to be untouchable.
The biggest case in Finnish criminal history.
Ransom Man on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It makes me sick to my stomach.
Starts tomorrow morning at 9.
It's 29 minutes to 7. Now you're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer is due to deliver a statement in Downing Street to set out how the government will respond to President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on the UK and other European allies unless they agree to his demands for the US to buy Greenland. The Prime Minister has told Mr. Trump it's wrong to apply such measures to NATO allies. António Guterres, the UN Secretary General, has said the US is exercising power outside the norms of international law. Speaking to this programme, he also calls for changes to the Security Council, saying it no longer represents the world that exists now. The Prime Minister of Spain has said his country has been experiencing a night of deep pain after at least 21 people died in a collision between two high-speed trains in Andalusia. One of the trains derailed on a straight part of the line and hit an oncoming train. China says its economy grew by 5% last year, meeting its annual growth target. However, it's one of the slowest rates in decades. Officials said the economy was facing challenges, including strong supply and weak demand. Volunteers are taking part in a trial to see if a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease can be detected by a finger prick blood test rather than expensive brain scans. The study includes 1,000 people from the UK, US and Canada. If successful, it could lead to a cost-effective screening programme for the disease. And Reform UK has welcomed the former Conservative MP Andrew Rosendale to the party following his defection last night. The former Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister represents Romford in East London. Reform, which now has 7 MPs in Parliament, has said he was a great addition. The Tories said Reform was welcome to him.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's 27 minutes to 7. So, as Alan says, the Prime Minister is going to be taking to Downing Street and the lectern this morning after an extraordinary weekend of diplomatic turmoil prompted by the US President Donald Trump. The focus of that press conference shortly after we come off air is, of course, Greenland. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is outside Downing Street. Henry, morning. Is this one of those circumstances where you can't actually diplomatically have it both ways? It's one of those circumstances where Starmer really does have to choose between Trump on the one hand and Europe on the other.
I think Sir Keir Starmer will try to some extent to continue to have it both ways. Let me explain what I mean by that, because he will reiterate what he said at the weekend, that Donald Trump's threat to impose tariffs over Greenland is wrong. Now, that is clearly a big deal for a prime minister who has set a lot of stall over the past year by getting close to President Trump and getting close to him in order to try to influence what he then does. However, I'm told that Sir Keir Starmer will spend a lot of time talking about the depth of the UK-US relationship over generations and why, as allies, you can have these kinds of conversations. He will argue that the way to address this is not through threats and tariffs, it's through calm discussion. But fundamentally, people I was speaking to last night were acknowledging that this is the clearest disagreement yet between the two of them in the year or so since Donald Trump became president, and that it clearly has the potential to lead to a broader rupture between the UK and the US.
And just for state what might seem obvious, Greenland is part of Denmark. Denmark is a NATO ally. Keir Starmer has put great weight on the NATO alliance, particularly with regards to Ukraine. So if Donald Trump did anything in Greenland which prompted NATO to respond, that again would be a pretty invidious choice for Starmer, because he has said time and time and time again that his policy towards Ukraine is really dictated by his being part of NATO.
I mean, I think Donald Trump doing something in Greenland which would require NATO to respond is sort of unimaginable, in the sense that what is NATO if many of its members are having to respond to an action by not only one of its members, but essentially its main member. So, I mean, I think those are the kinds of conversations, which are absolutely right, are beginning to happen. And I do think, you know, over the past 10 days or so, I've had lots of conversations with people in Whitehall and Westminster who have sought to kind of intellectualise and complexify this question and say, well, perhaps what Donald Trump really means is this, and perhaps we can respond to the broader thrust of Donald Trump's arguments by doing that. But I think what the president is making increasingly plain, and what Sir Keir Starmer is going to have to respond to before the nation today, is actually the fact that President Trump just means it. He thinks the US should have Greenland.
Quite. Henry, if we do just do one thought on matters closer to home, there's another defection, isn't there, from the Tories to Reform. This time it's Andrew Rosendale. Just tell us a bit about him and why he's gone.
Yeah, not an especially prominent name, even in Westminster, though he has been the MP for Romford since 2001, which made him one of the Conservatives' longest-serving MPs by far. He was on the Eurosceptic, socially conservative right of the Conservative Party, never achieved ministerial office in their 14 years in government, although he was until yesterday a shadow Foreign Office minister in Kemi Badenoch's team. I mean, it is striking that from Thursday to Sunday, Nigel Farage increased his parliamentary representation by 40%. He now commands a parliamentary party of seven MPs, but three of them were Conservative MPs not very long ago. And that will lead, I think, to more accusations that this is a reincarnation of sorts of the Conservative Party. Little wonder that they're talking up some sort of defection from a Labour figure, though not necessarily a Labour MP, later this week.
Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent in Downing Street, thank you.
Let's also speak to Nick Beek, our correspondent in Brussels, for the European view on the Greenland situation. Nick, I think there's an agreement that European leaders need to do something. It could be anything from firm words to huge retaliatory tariffs. The question is what?
Yeah, that's right, Anna. And I think this feels like a precarious moment for the EU, because it's been on this roller coaster ride for the past year, trying to placate or charm or manage Donald Trump. But this is the most dangerous turn yet. And what you've got is openly some EU leaders accusing Donald Trump of blackmail. And as you say, the dilemma here is if they don't do anything, they can look weak, and that may embolden Mr. Trump even further over Greenland. If they go too far, then there's the risk of a trade war with the US, their biggest partner. President Macron of France, he says the EU really needs to be tough at this moment. He's talked about using the EU's trade bazooka, as it's known. Basically, this would be counter-tariffs. It was a weapon that they designed originally to basically deal with bullying by a hostile external country. And at the time, they were thinking of China. You know, they weren't thinking of the United States. But you've got people like Giorgia Meloni of Italy saying that a trade war would be really damaging to both sides. She says there needs to be a diplomatic solution to this. And she's tried to characterize this as a misunderstanding of the EU and the US position on Greenland. But I think the problem, Anna, is that the positions of the two sides, are, you know, they're poles apart and they're completely incompatible with each other.
Yeah, and as you touch on there, Nick, actually for European leaders, trying to find a united solution will not be easy either.
No, it won't. And I think the next 72 hours are really crucial. There is talk, we're hearing at the moment, of one potential avenue to pursue being the threat of economic sanctions. Specifically, there's this 93 billion euro tariff program on US goods that was drawn up last year. But it's been on hold. And the reason that that was drawn up in the first place is because President Trump embarked on the global mission to hit various countries with tariffs. In the end, last July, they agreed on this sort of lopsided deal, which would mean that EU goods would face an extra 15% tariff going into the US, whereas American goods into the EU would face nothing. But a lot of the Europeans weren't happy with this. They drew up this list of a retaliation, 93 billion euros worth of goods. That's been on hold. It's being looked at again now. And also, the whole deal itself hasn't been properly ratified or signed off. And you've got key members of the European Parliament saying, look, we're not going to do this for now, hoping that they can exert some sort of pressure on President Trump. Mm-hmm. There's an emergency meeting here, Anna, on Thursday of all the EU leaders. So I think the next 72 hours will be crucial. And lots of people will be hoping that before then, whether it's in Davos, it's in Washington, D.C., maybe in Donald Trump's mind, something changes. And this then feels like a much less precarious place to be.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Thank you, Nick. Nick Beak there in Brussels.
19 minutes to 7, a single simple finger prick test that could spot Alzheimer's much earlier, much faster, much more cheaply than brain scans or lumbar punctures. That is the promise of a remarkable new international medical trial, which Fergus Walsh, our medical editor, can take us through. Fergus, good morning. What a prize that would be.
Yeah, absolutely indeed. And this technology for using blood tests to look for signs of Alzheimer's is really coming on leaps and bounds. And in fact, in the US, there's already a blood test which is approved for diagnosis. And what these tests do is they look for blood-based biomarkers, these chemical signals that show the presence in the brain of these rogue proteins, amyloid and tau, that can build up, you know, up to 15 years or so before the first symptoms of the disease emerge. But what this one does, it is just a couple of drops of blood which are drawn onto a piece of card. And the trial involving 1,000 volunteers in North America and also in the UK will look and see whether that those blood-based biomarkers can be assessed accurately. And all the volunteers will also have the state-of-the-art brain scans involving radioactive tracers that are really expensive and time-consuming, and also cognitive tests, and see whether the finger prick test is as good as the others.
And Fergus, just to be clear with these medical stories, as you always very explicitly are, this is not, we don't want to offer false hope to people with Alzheimer's today. This is more about future patients, and this is about an international trial. So the actual, commercial application of this technology, this medicine, could be some time off yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And worth saying that there's already a trial that started in September in the UK involving another 1,000 or so volunteers being run by the two big Alzheimer's charities that's looking at a traditional blood draw using a needle and syringe to see how in real world settings using this to screen patients as well as cognitive tests, whether that could offer a screening program. Now, why all this is important, and this is for the future, is that there are a raft of potential new drugs coming down the track that will target early stage Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia. And that's why this needs to be lined up soon, because when those drugs become available, people will have to be told accurately whether they have these rogue proteins in their brain.
Fergus Walsh, our medical editor, thank you.
17 minutes to seven. It's one of those mornings where most of the front pages of the papers are about the same story, and they are generally all in agreement on their view of it. It is Donald Trump. It is his tariffs, which he's putting on countries which don't agree with his plan to annex Greenland. The Financial Times this morning says the EU is priming a €93 billion retaliatory tariffs package to try and encourage him to stand down. It looks like it's a bit of brinkmanship involved. They're calling it leverage for meetings at Davos, but they do point into the paper to their comments section, page 23. Over the past year, European leaders have tried appeasement and flattery. This is where it's got them. They need to push back now. The Daily Telegraph similarly says Europe is threatening to strike back over Greenland. This is on the tariffs front. Quite a simple headline on the Daily Mirror this morning. It simply says Trump's Greenland madness, blackmail.
Absolutely extraordinary story, quite high on the FT website this morning, about what's happening with China and its demography. China registers lowest number of births since records began. Population falls for the fourth year in a row as policymakers struggle with demographic crisis. I should say this comes on the day that China's reported 5% annual growth. But China last year registered the lowest number of births since records began, marking the fourth consecutive year of population decline. On Monday, the government reported 7.92 million babies were born in 2025, down from 9.54 million the year before. A massive, massive drop, and the lowest number of births since 1949. Interesting story in the I paper, just because I know you're about to cover this, Anna. Page 7 is an exclusive from Lucy Heath. Water bosses could be fined personally over sewage spills. Ministers to outline plans for stricter accountability. Water company bosses could be fined from their own pockets for issues including sewage spills and leaks under a new industry regulator.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that just now. Actually, just to let you know as well, a bit of breaking news. We've been reporting that high-speed train crash in Spain. The Spanish Interior Minister has just confirmed that the death toll from that has now risen. It was in its early 20s. It's now gone up to 39. So we'll get the latest on that after 7 o'clock this morning as well. Let's talk, though, at 14 minutes to seven about that new white paper that's coming this week on the water industry and what the government is promising from it to hold bosses to account, to look at things like water outages, sewage spills, all of it, and try and make things better. Well, James Wallace is the chief executive of River Action. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
What are your thoughts on what you've seen so far?
Well, it's good to see the government seem to be acting, although I would question the logic to this. So good for them for saying that water bosses should be fined out of pocket and that they might be possibly banned from occupying jobs like this in the future, maybe even face jail time. But if you worked in the landfill sector doing the same job under the Proceeds of Crime Act, this would already be the case. So why are we having to go through this all over again? We've had the Independent Water Commission last year and we were pleased to see that happen. So John Cunliffe's made his recommendations. We need this white paper to go a lot further than just making sure bosses are held accountable.
So what kind of thing are you suggesting? And are you just going to suggest it here to us? Or are you actually in conversations with the people who are going to be working on this?
Well, we are in conversation with them, yes, and lobbying hard, as are lots of other environmental groups, to try and make sure that the government go a lot further than this. So what we'd like to see is an end to this failed privatisation experiment. As long as water companies are owned and operated and invested in for the benefit of private equity, how on earth are they meant to make the differences that we need to see? We've had decades and decades of pollution and often illegal behaviour. And the only way we're really going to see that is if there's a complete reset. We also need to make sure that the water regulators are changed. And we know that the government are making progress in that, we believe anyway. And that needs to see resources as well. Rachel Reeves needs to give them the cash they need. So if you combine the two, making sure that those companies are operated for public benefit and environmental outcomes, and secondly, that the water regulator operates and has its teeth given back, then we might start to see some proper changes.
The water industry, for their part, are saying that they are trying. They're saying they've invested billions in this. They say last year it was $9.2 billion, which is the highest capital investment ever in a single year. Do you feel that they are trying?
Well, I'm sure that there are some people who are and at least trying to convince us that they are. But unfortunately, as long as you have, for example, the board of a water company is predominantly and pretty much always a bunch of investors looking after the needs of investors across the world, then how can they be making decisions that are going to benefit me and you as customers? Just use Thames Water as an example. They are the very obvious case for what we refer to and the law refers to as special administration regime. If we were to use that for them, that would be put out of the misery. The debt would be wiped off. Government would be able to issue government-backed bonds, which would save a huge amount of money that could be then invested in actually doing the work they should be doing. And then in due course, when the government's gone through that process, they could be then having an exit, which makes sure those principles I've described already are put into place. Until we see that, I really can't see much changing at all. And the amount of money that's being talked about, they are investing with the words you used, Anna, which nothing against you, but the words that are being touted by the industry, they are not investing a penny. We are. It's our money coming from our bills.
Mm. They were the industry words that I was quoting to you. Yes. Thames Water, for example, say they invest around £2 billion each year. It'll be interesting to see what's in that white paper. James Wallace, the Chief Executive of River Action. Thank you.
It's 11 minutes to 7. In an hour's time, we're going to be talking about a potential social media ban in the UK and whether or not we should have it, because 61 Labour MPs have written an open letter to the Prime Minister this morning saying the UK should ban social media for under-16s. And France is moving sharply in that direction, what you might call the Australian direction, except France has gone further. From September, in France, children under 15 will be banned from social media, and mobile phones, which are already banned in primary and middle schools, will also be banned in all French high schools. This follows a French parliamentary report into the effect of TikTok on children that was published last September and concluded TikTok was like, and I quote, a slow poison. TikTok was very robust in its response, arguing the platform is being used as a scapegoat for industry-wide and societal challenges. Sarah El-Eri, a French minister and High Commissioner for Children, she's coming to London today to attend the Generative AI for Education Summit at the invitation of Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary. And when I spoke to her a short time ago, I asked if there's public support in France for such a move.
Yes, the French government believes that doing nothing is no longer possible. The parliamentary inquiry on TikTok and its psychological effect on children has been very important. It helped to raise, to bring facts into the public debate. I recently received a report from the youth group in France, and it's clearly recommended banning social media for under 15. We must act fast and firmly. We cannot leave children on TikTok without knowing what happened behind the scenes. Many people and parents feel lost. Around 70% say they do not really know what their children do online.
But it's interesting you talk about TikTok, because I know this France's parliamentary report last September focused on TikTok very heavily. And as you know, TikTok pushed back very aggressively on that. And I just want to put to you what TikTok said. They've said, first of all, they reject your misleading characterization, which attempts to scapegoat their company for industry-wide and societal challenges. And they also point out that last year in France, 98% of any content on TikTok which was infringing terms of service was taken down by moderation. 98% is not a bad record, is it?
Okay, but the time spent on screen is a key issue. Families have the right to disconnect. This also reduces stress for children. Using screen before sleep clearly affects sleep quality. This was consequence on concentration, learning and cognitive development.
But what do you make of the argument, which we're going to hear in the UK, might hear later on this programme, that if you ban social media, what you end up doing is actually, you don't stop children getting access to smartphones and social media, you just push them into the hands of the dark web, and therefore a ban is very difficult to enforce.
I'm not sure, because platforms have a clear responsibility, but these rules must be applied strongly. For example, just let me give one example. With sure. Grok, user can ask the system to undress women and children. This is completely unacceptable. This issue be central in today's discussion. And the UK, I think, is strongly engaged on these topics. So it's a global fight, yes, really. But working together, we will be stronger and we will be success for our child.
Thank you very much indeed for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll just say that was Sarah El Ari, a French minister and High Commissioner for Children. As I say, she's coming to the UK today to speak to Ofcom, among others. We're going to come back to that story in an hour's time.
7 minutes to seven now. Downing Street says the Prime Minister has told Donald Trump that applying extra tariffs on countries who disagree with his plans to annex Greenland is wrong. EU leaders will discuss it at an emergency summit in the next few days. They're already talking about large packages, potentially, of retaliatory tariffs. So how might it all affect us here? Ian Robertson is a former BMW board member, currently chairman of Dyson. Good morning.
Good morning.
As I said, there's a lot being said already about what the EU might do. Do we choose to align with them at this moment or do something slightly different, do you think?
Well, I think the politics is one thing, but from an industry point of view, the issue brings a lot more uncertainty. Trade deals are normally multi-year and give a stability outlook. And it's only, you know, in the recent 12 months that a lot of companies have been adjusting their business model and as a result have set their goals for this year and next year that assumed a 10% tariff. And now there potentially is another 10% on top of that, which would mean in total 22%. So a very significant rise at a time when American consumers are lacking the confidence and do not accept price increases relatively well. So I think there's a lot of uncertainties that suddenly come into everyone's business model. Coupled with that, of course, if you looked at the UK, the biggest exporter would have been JLR, and they had a very significant cyber attack during the latter part of last year. So a big disruption in their whole supply line, and it's not just JLR, it's all of their tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four suppliers, many of them very small. And this potentially brings another set of shocks into that system. So, you know, overall, I think the most difficult thing here is the uncertainty moving forward rather than the particular moment in time, because now it appears that trade deals are going to be subject to whatever political influences various governments, in particular in the US, want to consider.
But where you say appears as well, that's the key part of it, because, of course, Donald Trump has threatened and then pulled back on tariffs several times already. There's still a court case ongoing in the US as to whether or not he even has the power to do that. So but if you're a business here or in Europe, you can't not plan, though, can you?
Sure. And therefore, you need more flexibility. But you know, the world is pretty uncertain in general. So, you know, the growth of the Chinese market over the last 10, 15 years has happened. The Chinese market's under some pressure now from a growth point of view, particularly in automotive. So a lot of the automotive supply has been taken away by local domestic Chinese makers. So you know, there isn't the option of many other growth markets around the world. And the US is somewhat around 20-25% of anybody's export market.
And more broadly, I suppose, there are still another 4 years to go of the Trump administration. So the wider question is this going to be a technique now, a tool that is used increasingly often?
Well, hopefully it's 3 years to go. But from that perspective, you're absolutely right that, you know, the stability that you would have from a trade deal is now in question, because it now it falls to a political intervention on a subject which is not related to the particular trade deal. So it becomes a tool to influence other factors. And that is bringing that uncertainty. And the uncertainty means that companies have to be a lot more flexible. But ultimately, what it means is that costs need to come down somewhere. So I can assume now that many, many companies across the European arena will be looking at cost savings. They'll be looking at specification changes. They'll be looking at ways in which they could mitigate any duty effects that will come in very, very quickly, because you are now looking at 2-3 weeks until these tariffs potentially do arise.
Yeah. Ian Robertson, Chairman of Dyson, thanks for joining us.
3 minutes to seven this afternoon on Radio 4 and indeed on BBC Sounds. Justin has a new series which is looking at five significant shifts in US foreign policy.
Ever wondered why America acts the way it does on the world stage? From Understand from BBC Radio 4 comes a new series exploring US foreign policy in five doctrines. We're telling the story of five big ideas that changed everything, from the Monroe Doctrine to Donald Trump. How do these doctrines shape the world we live in now? And what do they tell us about what's happening in America today? US Foreign Policy in Five Doctrines, presented by me, Justin Webb, begins this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas. Morning.
Morning to you, Anna. We've got a bit of a mixed weather picture today. For many of us, misty, murky, damp day ahead, but there will be some glimpses of sunshine too. So three zones of weather, and we'll start with all of England away from the southwest. A pretty cloudy sort of day, some mist and some fog patches around this morning. We're also going to see patchy outbreaks of rain, particularly so for the Pennines, down towards the Midlands, into central southern England as well. But there will be a little bit of sunshine developing in the southeast of England and East Anglia later on. And then a little bit further west, so if you're across the southwest of England, Wales and much of Scotland, it is quite a cold start to the day. We've got a bit of frost and some dense fog patches. Mist and fog should clear away, and then much of the region is going to be dry with some sunny spells, but there will be rain just pushing into the far west, particularly the Isles of Scilly, the Western Isles as well. And for Northern Ireland today, a slow-moving weather front is going to be draped across Northern Ireland all day. So cloudy and wet, on and off outbreaks of rain really all day today. Top temperatures somewhere between around 5 to 11 degrees north to south across the UK. But then things are going to turn increasingly wet and windy from the southwest as low pressure moves in overnight, bringing us some strong winds and heavy rain in the west during tomorrow.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 19th of January. The headlines today: a collision between two high-speed trains in southern Spain has killed at least 39 people. A business group has appealed for cool heads in the transatlantic crisis over Greenland as the UK and EU weigh up their response to President Trump's threat of tariffs. And an international trial is underway to see if a finger prick blood test can help diagnose Alzheimer's disease.
Coming up in the next hour, is the government preparing to ban social media for under 16s? A former education minister will explain why she thinks it's now ready to act. In an exclusive interview, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres tells Anna that the United Nations is struggling to adapt and why the Security Council needs reform.
The multilateral institutions we have, namely the United Nations, are today not adapted to the dramatic problems and challenges of the world that we face.
And as we celebrate the year of reading, the author Nick Hornby reflects on the book that changed him.
I think my reading had become very stuck after university, and suddenly there was this fresh, funny, soulful, sad writer in my life.
The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, says his country has experienced a night of deep pain after at least 39 people died in a collision between two high-speed trains in Andalusia. One of the trains derailed and hit an oncoming train outside the town of Adamuth near Cordoba. Dozens of people on board were injured, at least 24 of them seriously. Officials say the number of dead could rise. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
One of the trains was travelling from Malaga to Atocha station here in the capital when it derailed about an hour into its journey, colliding with another train travelling in the opposite direction. A firefighter said retrieving people from the wreckage was difficult as carriages were twisted with passengers inside. One witness said one carriage had completely overturned. The mayor of Adamuth, Rafael Moreno, reached the scene soon after the accident. He described it as being like a nightmare. The Transport Minister, Oscar Puente, said the derailment was extremely strange given that it had not taken place on a curve and the line had been revamped only last year. An investigation has now begun into what happened, although it's not expected to report back for at least a month. Spain's high-speed rail network is one of the largest in the world and is admired around Europe. This is the worst rail accident in the country since 80 people died in 2013 in a crash near Santiago de Compostela.
Sir Keir Starmer is to make a statement in Downing Street this morning to outline the government's response to President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on countries opposing his takeover of Greenland. The Prime Minister has already spoken on the phone to Mr. Trump, saying it's wrong to target NATO allies in this way. Here's our political correspondent Joe Pike.
Government sources say Sakir is holding the hastily arranged news conference because he believes voters, and in particular businesses, need to understand how his government plans to respond to the possibility of 10% tariffs in less than a fortnight. The Prime Minister is expected to reiterate today what he told Donald Trump in a phone call yesterday, that applying tariffs on allies for pursuing the collective security of NATO is completely wrong. Opposition parties have been united in condemning the White House's threat. The Liberal Democrats have gone further than most in calling for retaliatory tariffs and other measures which they say will hit Trump and his cronies where it hurts. President Trump is taking a large US delegation to the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos this week. Sakir is not currently planning to attend, but Number 10 sources have said it is possible that could change.
A European Union diplomat says the bloc is committed to a diplomatic solution with the United States. Plans are also being drawn up for retaliatory action, as our Europe editor Katja Adler reports from Brussels.
The EU is considering imposing €93 billion worth of tariffs on the United States, or restricting the access of American companies to the bloc's single market, if Donald Trump makes good on his promise to impose tariffs on any country that gets in the way of his takeover of Greenland, a territory of Denmark. The EU's retaliatory measures are being prepared to give Brussels leverage in talks with the US president in Davos this week, where the EU hopes to reach some kind of compromise. France and Germany's finance ministers meet in Berlin today to establish a joint position. With transatlantic defence and economic relations hanging in the balance, EU leaders say they'll meet in Brussels for an emergency summit, probably on Thursday.
Richard Rumbelow of Make UK, which represents British manufacturers, told us there would be concern in company boardrooms about the possibility of more tariffs, and he appealed for cool heads.
This just adds additional uncertainty to what has been a difficult time in terms of trade with the US. I think what's really important here at this point is we have effective trade diplomacy from the UK. I don't think this is a time for an immediate retaliatory action against the US.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has accused the US of exercising power outside the norms of international law. In an interview with this programme, he also calls for significant changes to the UN Security Council, as our diplomatic correspondent James Landell reports.
The Security Council is the most powerful body at the United Nations, with the US, China, Russia, France and the UK as permanent members. But Antonio Guterres said it was now ineffective and no longer represented the world that existed today. The Council's composition, he said, should be changed to regain its legitimacy. He also said the power of permanent members to veto decisions should be limited. Some, he said, were using their veto to frustrate the will of a huge number of UN members in ways that were very difficult to swallow. In recent years, the US has vetoed decisions on Gaza, Russia, on Ukraine. After the attack on Venezuela and threats against Greenland, Mr. Guterres accused the US of disrespecting international law and dismissing multilateral solutions as irrelevant. He also criticised the US for seeking quick ceasefires that did not last because the root causes of conflict were not addressed.
Official figures show China's economy grew by 5% last year, meeting the target set by the country's president Xi Jinping. According to the data, China also experienced its lowest birth rate on record in 2025. An international trial is underway among a group of over 60s to see if their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease can be detected in a test that requires just a few drops of blood. The study involves 1,000 volunteers across the UK, Canada and US. It will compare the results of finger prick blood testing with specialised brain scans, which are time-consuming and expensive. Our medical editor Fergus Walsh has more.
Diagnosing Alzheimer's from a blood sample is a technology that is rapidly coming of age. It analyses so-called blood-based biomarkers, which show the presence of rogue proteins in the brain that can accumulate 15 years before the first symptoms of the disease are seen. There's already one US-approved blood test for Alzheimer's, which involves a traditional blood draw using a needle and syringe. The finger prick test involves just a few drops of blood and could potentially be done at home and posted to a clinic for analysis. The study is being led by the medical research charity LifeArc, which said, if successful, it could lead to a cost-effective screening program for Alzheimer's.
Reform UK has gained another MP after Andrew Rosendale defected to the party from the Conservatives last night. He'd been serving as a shadow Foreign Office Minister, but said the Tories under Kemi Badenoch weren't willing to learn from their mistakes. His departure follows that of Robert Jenrick. Here's our political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
From Thursday to Sunday, with more than a nudge from Kemi Badenoch, of course, Reform UK increased its representation in the House of Commons by 40%. Nigel Farage is now the leader of a parliamentary party of seven MPs, and having set a deadline of the 7th of May for any other Conservatives to defect, that number may well grow before long. Mr Rosendale has been the MP for Romford in Greater London since 2001, which had made him one of the Conservatives' longest-serving MPs. He was on the Eurosceptic, socially conservative right of the Conservative Party and never achieved ministerial office in their 14 years in government. Mr Rosendale said that Reform UK was now the only political movement that is genuinely willing to fight for the best interests of the United Kingdom. Mr Farage hailed a great addition to his team, while the Conservatives said Mr Rosendale had been threatening to defect for months and that Reform were welcome to him.
That was our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
Thank you, Alan. It's 9 minutes past seven now. Let's get the very latest on that high-speed train collision in Spain overnight that we now know has killed at least 39 people. The pictures from the scene are, as you would imagine, graphic and distressing. You can see where the two carriages have come together and then one of them has twisted so it's leaning onto its side. You can see the blue lights, the emergency services working, and actually there's pictures from inside one of those carriages as well where the end is just ripped open and you can see people trying to climb out. There is a lot of very delicate and difficult emergency work that has been going on there overnight. We can speak to Clara Nuno, who's a freelance journalist at Atocha station in Madrid. Clara, just give us some of the detail that we know at this stage.
Well, right now, as you said, there's at least 39 death people, but the toll will probably be recent. And right now, the last news is that a lot of families that are in distress, that are anxious, are calling the family members because people are unable to contact their families. We don't know how many people are disappeared. We don't know which are dead, which are in hospitals. And one thing that the people that are working in the rescue of the trains right now there, while the sun is rising right now in Spain, they say they can hear the phones from people are calling their family members, so they can hear the phones are the sounding of the phones from inside the trains, but the people, of course, it's not picking up the phones. So this is a very delicate situation right now here in Spain.
And Clara, people of course are starting to ask what has happened. It is the worst train crash in Spain in a decade. The transport minister, Oscar Puente, has been speaking to El País, the newspaper, saying it's impossible to speculate on the causes, which he says are strange given that the train that this occurred on a straight stretch of track that was renovated last May. There's been a large investment, a practically new train. So people will be wondering how this could have happened.
Yeah, we don't know what has happened. We will probably don't know it in a lot of time. There's going to an ongoing investigation that they will probably take more than a year to figure it out what actually happened. There's also a matter of bad luck because if the other train didn't cross at the same time that the first time derailed, probably it will be a little bit less deadly. But sadly, this happened. Also, we have a very, as you probably know, in Spain, we have a very heated political climate right now. So there will be probably a lot of misinformation. So people should just go to official sources of information. And right now, there's nothing we can say about that. That is just strange. And it's very sad because also the man that was in the managing the train, which was the machinist, was a 27-year-old man. He also died in the impact. And we know nothing about how this could possibly happen right now.
And those questions continuing. Clara Nuno, thank you for joining us at Atocha station there in Madrid.
12 minutes past seven, in a couple of hours, the Prime Minister will give a press conference in which he will explain how the government intends to respond to the threat of US trade tariffs over the future of Greenland. A bit of context for you. Under the 1951 Greenland Defence Agreement, the US does have the right to build as many bases and station as many troops as it wishes in Greenland. During its Cold War peak, the United States operated around 50 military installations across Greenland, from remote radar to weather and early warning stations built to detect Soviet bombers and missiles. The figure now, just one. Kellyanne Shaw was the Deputy Assistant to the President for International Economic Affairs and Deputy Director of the National Economic Council in the first Trump administration, and she kindly joins us now. Ms. Shaw, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us. You know President Trump very well. When he issues threats of tariffs, as he did over the weekend, what's he actually trying to do?
Well, I think the president uses tariffs for a variety of reasons. He's talked a lot about rebalancing trading relationships, securing supply chains. But in this case, just like it was the case in the Russian oil tariffs, this is about foreign policy. It's about using tariffs as leverage to achieve a non-economic objective. And in this case, it's about a closer relationship with Greenland.
Do you think he sincerely believes that there is a threat to American security from China or Russia and its activities or their activities in the Arctic Circle?
I do. And I think that based on my own experience working in the first administration, where I did work on the administration's Greenland policy. And back then, 6 years ago, we were very concerned about planned and announced investments by China, by China's Polar Belt and Road Initiative. It's naming itself a near Arctic nation, which is a term of art it made up just to lay claim to aspects of the high north. I think there are a number of security concerns up there. It really is the Wild West. It's a very unbridled wilderness. And what you heard the administration officials saying yesterday when they were asked on TV on our U.S. Sunday shows about this is that this is about military deterrence. And I do believe the president cares about this issue very much.
And just to be clear, do you think that there's more recent evidence that that threat from China or Russia in the Arctic Circle is ongoing? I know you said that 6 years ago when you were working in the first Trump administration, it was there. But do you think there's evidence more recently that that threat goes on?
Well, I'm no longer working in government, so not privy to the same information that some of my former colleagues would be. But look, what I'd say is that this is the direction of travel in terms of where some of the amphitheaters of foreign policy will be playing out in the future. And I think that aspects of this policy are future looking, meaning the administration sees where the trends are going, sees the world heading towards this great power competition, and wants to ensure that there's security in the high north and among the U.S. border.
In the end, how do you think this dispute over Greenland will be settled?
I think there's a negotiated outcome here. We'll see the president in Switzerland this week in Davos with a number of European leaders. I would imagine there'll be some very frank conversations. But when I see the president threatening tariffs, what I hear is I want to negotiate something here. And so I think we'll ultimately see something that works for Denmark, something that works for the United States, and something that works for Greenland.
What would the Trump administration say, do you think? What is their argument to the view from Europe and from NATO that Greenland belongs to another country, and that to a small, peaceable, sovereign NATO ally in Denmark?
Well, it does. I think that the NATO allies are correct about its current status. But what the president is saying is that he wants some sort of deal here. And what the administration is saying in terms of the justification for this is that Greenland is the second largest island on the planet. And there is a view that Denmark is not capable of defending Greenland. And so I think that's where you're seeing interest from the United States. But again, anything here would have to be the product of some sort of negotiated outcome that works for all three parties involved.
There was a very interesting line over the weekend suggesting that after Giorgia Meloni, the Italian leader, spoke to President Trump, she suggested there might have been a bit of a misunderstanding where he saw the deployment of European troops to Greenland as a kind of provocation, as an attempt to protect Greenland from America. Whereas, in fact, it might well have been that it was a direct response to his request that Europe does send more troops to Greenland to show they take Greenland seriously. Do you think it's possible that all this tariff talk might have arisen from a basic breakdown of diplomatic communication?
I think it's totally possible. And I will say, having been in the States last week, the reporting was that Europe was sending troops to Greenland to the president. And so maybe there was a miscommunication. But I do think that at the end of the day, these leaders are all going to be in person this week in Switzerland. And I think the temperature is going to come down as a result of those face-to-face conversations.
Can I ask you finally, given your former work on the National Economic Council, how do you think Donald Trump is doing politically at home?
Well, I think that the economy is growing at something like 4% GDP. We're seeing unprecedented highs in the stock market. I think the president is really pushing the U.S. economy in a way that is going to appeal to voters. Now, of course, the big issue in the United States right now is affordability and whether or not Americans feel like they can afford houses, groceries, send their kids to school. And so this is going to be the president and the administration's greatest challenge going into the midterms. But I think he's doing better at this point than he was even in his first term.
Kellyanne Shaw, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 18 minutes past seven. We've been talking already on the programme this morning about government attempts to more effectively regulate social media companies, particularly children's use of them. Amol's going to discuss that in more detail as well at 10 to 8. To try and appease those concerns, TikTok has been rolling out new age verification tools on its app across Europe, and they are using a British technology company to do it. Will's back with more on that.
Yeah, as you say, Anna, an area all around the world, isn't it? Australia, Europe, North America. To get ahead of that, TikTok has been trialling various different bits of age verification tech. In Europe, they've been working with Yoti, a digital identification firm, and their chief policy and regulatory officer, Julie Dawson, joins us. Julie, morning.
Good morning, Will.
And you've been working with TikTok here in the UK as well, haven't you? How does your tech work? What are people asked to do when they use it, when they're trying to verify their age on TikTok?
So there's several ways that people can use our tech. With TikTok, people self-declare their age at sign-up, and then TikTok uses a range of different signals to see if something seems awry. And if someone challenges the fact that they should or shouldn't enter, they can then prove their age with Yoti's facial age estimation as one of the options, or they're over 18, a credit card, or with an ID document. But the facial age estimation is the one you've probably heard of, which detects your live face, does a pixel level analysis, and instantly deletes the image. So the liveness is to check you're alive. We also check for injection attacks in the background, and that's about a year of accuracy for your sort of 12 to 17 year olds.
And can people challenge that again? Because I have seen some kind of reports that your tech isn't always 100% accurate, or from their perspective, it isn't.
So it's an estimation approach. I mean, me and you, we're all human estimators. We assess between sort of 4 and 8 years of accuracy. So this is about a year of accuracy. And obviously, it's what it's replacing is self-declaration of somebody who could be 2, 5, 10, who's self-declaring to be 13 or 16 or 18. So it is about a year of accuracy. We publish exactly the stats for different ages, skin tones, genders. But absolutely, there's about a year of accuracy. However, it's not deemed inaccurate enough. So that you might need a 3 or 5 year buffer for adult content where it's illegal for someone to access. You might have a buffer. So to be over 18 for adult content, you might add 3 years. For social media, that's not the case. And they say this is more inclusive approach than requiring somebody that might not own a credit card and might not have an ID document.
As a result, though, you hold an awful lot of people's data, don't you? Pretty sensitive data. And as we were hearing from the French minister just before 7 o'clock with Amol, potentially very young children's data as well. How do you protect that?
So that's perhaps the area that people misconstrue. So this, we're sent an image, we detect if that's live, do the analysis, and that is not at all stored. So there's no central database. There's no unique recognition, not one-to-one, not one-to-many. So each time on the fly, we're reassessing, this is a photo, is it live? Assess and delete the image instantly. So there's no retention of data of those faces of young people.
So you think the system is robust enough should, you know, as the debate is going to be today, more countries go Australia's way and implement these bans for social media use under 16s, that your software would be robust enough to deal with what would be a pretty big surge, I guess, in people potentially challenging those verifications?
So we've done over 1 billion age assurance checks, and we do over 1 million of these age checks via facial age estimation daily. So for a whole range of platforms, so Instagram, Facebook dating, Sony PlayStation, so spanning social, dating, gaming, adult content, the likes of OnlyFans, live streaming, but also physical retail and e-commerce. So absolutely it's something we take very seriously, looking at the security elements. But this has been designed to not create a central database and to be inclusive.
Julie, thanks for your time this morning. Julie Dawson there from Yoti.
Will, thank you. 22 minutes past seven. Prince Harry is due to give evidence at London's High Court this week in his and other high-profile figures' privacy lawsuits against the publisher of the Daily Mail, together with the former Liberal Democrat politician Sir Simon Hughes, the mother of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence, that's Doreen Lawrence, Baroness Lawrence of Clarendon, and also Sir Elton John and husband David Furnish and the actresses Sadie Frost and Elizabeth Hurley. Prince Harry is suing Associated Newspapers over alleged unlawful information gathering dating back 30 years. Let's speak to Katie Razzle, the BBC's media and culture editor. Katie, morning. In the long catalogue of various trials and investigations, how is this activity, what Prince Harry's doing, how is it different from his previous showdowns with the tabloids?
Well, yes, Amal, as you say, Prince Harry hasn't been afraid to take on the tabloids. He blames them for the death of his mother and the hounding, as he sees it, of his wife. And this is his third major court battle after he took on the Mirror Group and won, was awarded damages over phone hacking. Also News Group Newspapers, which publishes The Sun, and that case was settled as it was due to open with an apology for serious intrusion and an admission for the first time that private investigators working for The Sun had obtained information unlawfully. The reason why this one is different, well, it's different for various reasons. First of all, I would say these are arguably the most serious set of allegations levelled against a newspaper. So Prince Harry and, yes, as you say, six other high-profile names, they are alleging not just phone hacking, but also tapping landlines, blagging medical records, and even bugging celebrities' homes. And another reason why this is different, though, is because unlike the other cases he's pursued, no journalist or executive has ever been jailed, convicted or charged of any crime at any of the Mail newspapers over this kind of unlawful information gathering. Associated Newspapers never been caught up. They were never caught up in the phone hacking scandal. And at the Leveson inquiry back in 2011-2012, the editor at the time, Paul Dacre, said he was confident there'd be no cases of hacking at his newspapers. Now, Associated Newspapers say all these allegations, they say they're not just preposterous, but an affront to the hardworking journalists whose reputations and integrity are being wrongly traduced. This is based on a number of articles that the claimants allege show in various ways this unlawful information gathering, as it's called. And the Daily Mail publishers say the articles, many of which, as you say, came from 20 or more years ago, were never complained about at the time and came from responsible journalism based on legitimate sources.
Could the Mail say the case is out of time? Because this case was brought in October 2022 in civil litigations, and claimants have 6 years to bring a privacy claim. So the longer this goes on, the longer it sort of makes it harder for Prince Harry and the other claimants to win.
Yes, absolutely. And we expect that to be one of the arguments made by Associated Newspapers lawyers. So, as you said, there's a 6-year time limit for claiming breaches of privacy, starting from when the person realised that it happened. So people in this case, they have to show that they didn't know they had a potential case until much more recently and within that 6 years. And so that is one of the key things, you know, and Associated say that, well, they are claiming there's been a lot of backstory, arguments going on, legal argument going on for a long time over this case in court and outside. And one of the things that Associated is alleging is that friendly journalists published articles on fringe news websites to create artificial, what are called watershed moments. So the moment where the victim could then say that they had discovered the truth about what the papers had done. Now, the claimant side absolutely denies this. They say that isn't the case. That isn't how they found out about these things. But the judge is going to have to decide that.
Katie Razzle, media and culture editor. Thank you.
Let's get the sports at 26 minutes past seven with Carthy. Hello.
Morning. Thank you very much. It is day two of the first Grand Slam of the tennis season, the Australian Open, and the British number three, Jacob Fernley, is fighting back against Poland's Kamil Majstrek. Fernley was two sets down. He has just taken the third set, though. Earlier this morning, the women's British number three, Fran Jones, had to retire from her match with an injury. Senegal beat Morocco 1-0 to lift the Africa Cup of Nations trophy for the second time last night, but that result doesn't tell you the story of an extraordinary evening. The BBC's World Service reporter John Bennett is in Rabat. John, there was so much drama. Can you explain what happened and what the atmosphere was like with the hosts involved in that final?
Well, Carthy, everything just felt on edge in the stadium. So the starting point was a late Senegal goal, controversially ruled out. Then in injury time, Morocco star player Brahim Diaz claims he was pulled back in the box by a Senegal defender. So he protests. Eventually, the referee is sent to the screen by the video referee. Meanwhile, there are confrontations between staff members and players. The penalty is eventually given in injury time. Then in the most concerning moment, we see some Senegal fans trying to get onto the pitch. The Senegal coach ushers his players off the pitch in protest. But eventually, Senegal star man Sadio Mane appears to convince his teammates to play. So there's a 16-minute delay. Then this penalty to win the Africa Cup of Nations, Brahim Diaz taking it, is eventually taken. And inexplicably, he tries a panenka. He chips it into the arms of the goalkeeper. Astonishingly poor penalty at such a key moment. And in extra time, Senegal go on to win it. It was an astonishing final.
Well put into about 35 seconds there. Brahim Diaz, you mentioned that penalty. He had the chance to end Morocco's 50-year wait to lift the AFCON trophy, and he attempted the chipped penalty, known as the panenka. It did not work. What has been the reaction to that? And has Diaz been able to speak about it?
He hasn't been speaking afterwards. The Morocco players avoided the media. He actually picked up the top scorer award afterwards and looked in tears. Yeah. We did hear from the Morocco coach who said that what happened tonight doesn't honour Africa. That was his words. He described the opposition coach as not classy for taking the players off. The Senegal coach, Pape Diaw, actually did apologise for what happened. He says it was in the heat of the moment. And Sadio Mane actually confirmed to us that he played a big part in getting the Senegal players back on the pitch. At one stage, it looked as though the final would end without a result, but he got them back on the pitch. And he said, we have to give a good image for football.
Yeah, it was a pretty extraordinary evening. John Bennett in Rabat, thank you for filling us in on that. Just a couple of other headlines for you. And Premier League, Scottish Cup and Women's FA Cup results from the weekend are on the BBC Sport website. Bath, Leicester and Northampton are amongst the seven English teams and two Scottish teams into the last 16 of Rugby Union's European Champions Cup. And Kyron Wilson won his first Masters snooker title, beating John Higgins by 10 frames to 6.
Thank you, Carthy.
A game which will go down as one.
If you like this...
What are you telling me? You're a traitor.
Yes! Get in there!
Then you'll love the final week of The Traitors Uncloaked. We'll get to see how the final few faithful react when they find out who the traitors are. And we'll chat to celebrity fans to hear their theories on what's going to happen next.
This is mega. I feel like I'm back in the game.
They've done it again. As absolutely hooked.
See and hear it all in the nail-biting last week of The Traitors Uncloaked, the official visualised companion podcast with me, Ed Gamble. Watch on iPlayer, listen for more on BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather. Cloudy for most with patchy rain today. Brighter in West and South East England, Scotland and Wales.
Still to come on the programme, as you might have heard last week, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting appeared to back a ban on social media for under-16s.
I think this is not just a debate worthy of our time, it's a debate past time. And this has been the conversation of school gates, of parent WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups for some time.
Well, a former education minister thinks that a decision on that is imminent. She'll tell us why she believes that ministers are now ready to act. And we'll also hear from the NSPCC on why a total ban might not be the way forward. Most people agree there's a problem. It's how to deal with it that's under debate. So we'll do that just before 8 o'clock.
Indeed, we will. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan. It is 7:30. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Officials in Spain say at least 39 people are now known to have died after two high-speed trains collided in the south of the country. Dozens more were injured in the crash outside the town of Adamuth near Cordoba. One government minister has described what happened as extremely strange, given the trains were on straight section and the tracks had been updated last year. Sir Keir Starmer is due to deliver a statement in Downing Street to set out how the government will respond to President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on the UK and other European allies unless they agree to his demands for the US to buy Greenland. The Prime Minister has told Mr. Trump it is wrong to apply such measures to NATO allies. European countries have also been holding talks about possible retaliatory measures against the United States. EU leaders will hold an emergency summit on Thursday to discuss whether to apply their own tariffs or block US firms from the European single market. Experts say that a trial into the effectiveness of finger prick blood tests in determining a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease could transform the diagnosis process. The study will compare the results from the test against the gold standard approach of expensive specialised brain scans. The Duke of Sussex civil case against the publisher of the Daily Mail over allegations of unlawful information gathering is due to begin at the High Court. Associated Newspapers Limited has denied the claims. Analysis suggests total earnings for 15 of the world's biggest women's football teams surpassed 150 million euros for the first time last year. Arsenal women top the 2026 Deloitte Football Money League, with Chelsea second and Barcelona third.
Thank you, Alan. It's 28 minutes to eight. The UN Secretary General, speaking exclusively to this programme, has said that the US believes it's above international law and that that is contributing to a world in chaos. I sat down over the weekend with Antonio Guterres, who's in his final year in that job, and he told me that brazen violations of international law, including by Donald Trump's America, were a threat to the very principles that the UN was founded on. He also said the UN Security Council, which has seen resolutions to try to end the wars in Gaza and Ukraine vetoed by permanent members, the US and Russia, should now be reformed. I asked him how we should deal with a world in which nations are now moving further and further apart.
We are witnessing a situation of total impunity. Conflicts that before were localized are now conflicts in which different entities get involved, creating situations in which it's very difficult to find a solution. And this is what we are witnessing, crisis after crisis after crisis, with the sense that anyone can do whatever they want because nothing will happen to them. We see military expenditures growing exponentially, but humanitarian aid diminishing tragically. We are having more and more difficulties to support the people that is dying, the people that is suffering hunger, and the frustration to see people dying, knowing that we could solve their problem and that we do not have the resources to do so, that is terrible.
We use the word impunity, and you've talked about brazen violations of international law. There are countries that we've seen do that time after time, year after year. But the US is in the mix now, in a way that we've never seen before. And Donald Trump is violating international law in a way that we've never seen before, isn't he?
It's more general than that. It's the concept itself that is unfortunately losing ground. There are those that believe that the power of law should be replaced by the law of power. And indeed, when one sees the present policy of the United States, there is a clear conviction that multilateral solutions are not relevant, and that what matters is the exercise of the power and the influence of the United States, and sometimes in this respect by the norms of international law.
Donald Trump's been very clear about that. He spoke at the UN General Assembly back in September, and his words were scathing. He talked about the wars that he had ended. He said, it's too bad that I had to do these things instead of the United Nations doing them. The United Nations did not even try to help in any of them. What is the purpose, he said, of the United Nations?
Let's be clear. There has been a number of peace initiatives from the United States, and we support them. But it's important to recognize that the UN is extremely engaged in the solution of all these conflicts. But the UN has no leverage. And indeed, it is true that big powers have a stronger leverage. The question is whether this leverage allows for a quick impact or whether the root causes of conflict are solved. And there is a big difference between the two things. We have many ceasefires, but then the fire breaks again. And unless you address the root causes, and the root causes are related to the questions of development in which the UN is involved, the root causes are related to the questions of human rights in which the UN is involved, the root causes are related to the cohesion of the societies in which we are involved. And so I believe that the need for this work in depth is essential, and it's not enough just to reach a quick agreement that sometimes it's very difficult.
So when Donald Trump questions the purpose and the usefulness of the United Nations in this day and age, it is an attack on your institution and on you.
But I believe the United Nations is doing, with all these difficulties and all these problems, with the lack of resources, is doing something that we are very proud of. You see UN staff supporting people in the most remote and dangerous positions in the world. We had in Gaza 400 staff members killed, losing their lives helping people. So we are in the front lines of all the battles of today's world, and I'm very proud of the work the UN is doing. Of course, we need to do better, we need to do more. That's why we are involved in a very deep reform.
Let's talk about some of the priorities, and you mentioned one of them there, which is Gaza. And you also gave us an insight into how deeply personal and difficult it must be, as you said, to see your staff losing their lives there, being killed there. When we look at what the UN has tried to do in Gaza, you've tried to deliver humanitarian aid, which is your purpose, which is something you do around the world, but you've been prevented from doing it. The Security Council has tried time and time again to establish resolutions for humanitarian pauses in the fighting to try and open up aid, but that hasn't happened because it's been vetoed by the US. When you look at Gaza, does that feel like a failing for the United Nations? Something where you should have made a difference but couldn't?
Well, of course we should. But let's be clear. For a long time, Israel was saying that humanitarian aid was not distributed because the UN was not able to do so. And we were saying that we are not distributing because we are simply not allowed to do so. The obstacles are too many. And then there was a ceasefire. And all of a sudden, there was a massive flow of humanitarian aid. We were ready. Provided we had the conditions. Things have considerably improved in Gaza, even if life in Gaza is still an absolute tragedy.
But are there moments when you have felt powerless in that conflict? Powerless to act, powerless to deliver aid, powerless to stop what was happening?
Of course, whenever Israel would not allow us to move into Gaza, we couldn't move into Gaza. Fortunately, as I said, now things have improved, and I hope that they will go on improving because the needs are still huge.
You've talked about reform in various different sectors, and we talked about the way that veto countries are able to stop things happening. We talked about it happening on Gaza, but it's also happened on Ukraine as well, where Russia has repeatedly vetoed humanitarian pauses, ceasefires, ends to the fighting. Do you think it's time now for the Security Council structure to be reformed?
The Security Council was created after the Second World War. You have three European countries as permanent members of the Security Council. I mean, the Security Council no longer represents the world that today exists.
And so, you also have protagonists who are able to frustrate the will of a huge number of other member countries.
So, first, there is a problem of legitimacy and of the composition. Second, the fact that the veto power is used in the protection of the interests of the members themselves. There was an interesting proposal by the UK and France to limit the veto power to situations of atrocities and others of the kind. And I would very strongly encourage not only the change of composition of the Security Council, that is absolutely essential to regain legitimacy, but also to limit the veto power in order to avoid the kind of blockages that we are witnessing that are very difficult to accept and very difficult to swallow.
That makes people question the purpose and the value of the United Nations.
The question is not the United Nations. The question is the member states. It's not the United Nations that creates the situations that you mentioned, or it's not the United Nations that deliberately doesn't stop them.
No, but people say if the United Nations has no power,
if I may,
and the mechanisms
it's the action of member states that creates the problems and do not allow the problems to be solved. Now, the drama is that the multilateral institutions we have, namely the United Nations, are today not adapted to the dramatic problems and challenges of the world that we face. And that is why reform is necessary. And we are doing a huge effort to make the UN more effective, more cost-effective, more united, and more able to respond to the needs of the people we care for.
And when we look at Venezuela, for example, and I feel that the themes and the countries and the conflicts that we keep talking about keep bringing us back to that point you made about brazen violations of international law. We saw the US go in there. We saw them seize the president of the country. Again, we come back to that word that you used, impunity. acting with impunity.
But you need to see the whole picture in Venezuela. You have violations of human rights.
Yes, it is.
We shouldn't forget that.
We shouldn't forget that.
But
no, that's very important. The second point is that
this does not legitimate the use of force, because the use of force or the threat to use of force, except in self-defense, are a violation of international law. We have the paradoxical situation to a certain extent in which the regime is still in place. And the big discussions are more about oil than about the human rights of the Venezuelan people.
You have identified a violation of the UN Charter with what happened in Venezuela. And when you see world leaders, and here in the UK as well, and the response to that is muted, do you feel that they are speaking up strongly enough in defence of the UN Charter, in defence of international law?
People are sometimes reluctant to confront the powerful. But the truth is that if we don't confront the powerful, we'll never be able to have a better world.
Do you think the United Nations can survive the age of President Trump?
I have no doubt about it. I have a lot of confidence in the future of humankind, and I'm fighting as much as I can in order to make sure that the UN is part of that renewal that I believe will become inevitable.
Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I also, you heard, we covered a real range of topics there. I also asked him about the situation in Iran, and you can hear what he had to say about that after 8:30.
17 minutes to 8. Here on Today, we're marking the National Year of Reading, which is focused on getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. Some of our best-known authors are reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. Today, it's Nick Hornby, known for numerous hugely popular books, including High Fidelity, About a Boy, and his memoir Fever Pitch. And he has chosen Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant by Anne Tyler, first published in 1982 by Knopf.
I think the book that reignited my love of reading was Anne Tyler's Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. I was probably in my mid to late 20s when I found it. I was just browsing in a bookshop. And I think my reading had become very stuck after university. I think it probably does for a lot of people who studied English at university. I'd been reading mostly old things. I didn't know much about new things, and my appetite for reading had gone, really, after studying books for so long. And suddenly there was this fresh, funny, soulful, sad writer in my life. Anne Tyler's American, and actually it was her and several other American writers, including Laurie Moore and Tobias Wolff and Raymond Carver, that sort of attacked me from all sides. And it was something about voice and the conversational style in which they wrote that enticed me in. It's the readability that I think is so important, especially when you're working or you've got kids. It can be, well, it's the most important thing, I think, the idea that you want to spend time in this book. So this is right from the beginning of the book. It begins with a lady called Pearl dying. And this is the night that her husband left her. One Sunday night in 1944, he said he didn't want to stay married. They were sending him to Norfolk, he said, but he thought it best if he went alone. Pearl felt she was sinking in at the centre, like someone given a stomach punch. Yet part of her experienced an alert form of interest, as if this were happening in a story. Why? She asked him, calmly enough. He didn't answer. Beck, why? All he did was study his fists. He looked like a young and belligerent schoolboy waiting out a scolding. She made her voice even quieter. It was important to learn the reason. Wouldn't he just tell her what it was? He told her, he said. She lowered herself, shaking, into the chair across from him. She looked at his left temple, in which a pulse ticked. He was just passing through some mood, was all. He would change his mind in the morning. We'll sleep on it, she told him. But he said, it's tonight I'm going. One of the things that strikes you about the passage is that it's simple, but it's also, I think, incredibly sympathetic, obviously, to the woman who's being dumped. But the observation of the behavior of the man is not without love, I would say, and his pain is evident. I'd say her distinguishing feature is the love she has for her characters in all her books. She had a completely transformative effect on me because the moment I read her, I wanted to write prose, and I wanted to write prose exactly like her. Obviously, I was a long way away from being able to do that, but I could somehow see what the field was that I should be working in. So she was a huge inspiration on me.
That is Nick Hornby, the brilliant Nick Hornby. And do share yours as well, by the way, if there's a particular book that either ignited or reignited your love of reading. You can tell us about it. You can drop us a voice note on WhatsApp if you like, 0330 123 4346, or you can email today at bbc.co.uk. It's 13 minutes to 8 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn.
Good morning. This weekend has been dominated by headlines over the future of Greenland, a territory that the United States government, either for reasons of defence or because of its natural assets, is keen to possess. On Saturday, a large proportion of the island's tiny population risked the ice and snow to go out and demonstrate. They strongly expressed their desire to remain part of Denmark, and indeed the last time Greenlanders were asked, an overwhelming majority opposed coming under US control. However, even as they were demonstrating, the stakes are raised again, with the American government imposing tariffs on European allies who have come out in support of Denmark's position. The message is clear. If Europe wants to go on supporting the Danish position, it will cost them. The whole affair reminds me of an especially vivid story in the Old Testament. King Ahab wants to own a vineyard that belongs to Naboth, but Naboth refuses to sell. Ahab and his wife Jezebel, however, are tenacious and determined, and they won't take no for an answer. Instead, they think and plan, and eventually come up with a plot. They hire scoundrels who publicly sully the reputation of Naboth by accusing him of cursing God and the king. On the basis of this slander, Naboth is stoned, and Ahab claims his vineyard. Of course, the story doesn't end there. God sends Elijah the prophet, who speaks words of judgment over the king, and Ahab soon humbly repents in sackcloth. What intrigues me about the story is why Naboth feels he can't sell his vineyard, a step which would have avoided conflict with a determined royal couple. The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance, Naboth says boldly. In other words, he doesn't feel that his vineyard is his to give away. It belongs not just to him in a personal capacity, but to his ancestors and to those who are still to come. He holds it on trust, so it is simply not a disposable asset. Which is surely the quandary of the Danish government. Control of ancestral lands is a contentious and often bitter matter the world over. As long as the people of Greenland want to retain their ancient governance arrangements, there is a bond of trust in place. Whatever pressure may be applied, this land, with its people, cannot become a disposable asset. It's very hard to predict what will happen next in Greenland. A fear for many is a military campaign and a splitting of the NATO alliance that would have major global consequences. But as Elijah the prophet reminds us, minds and hearts can always change.
That was Thought for the Day with Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn. It's 10 to 8.
61 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister, it's an open letter, urging him to bring in a social media ban for children under 16. This week, members of the House of Lords are likely to vote on an amendment to the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill, which would prevent under 16s from accessing social media. All this follows Kemi Badenoch saying social media should be banned for under 16s and smartphones should be banned from schools. Labour's Andy Burnham posted on X in response to Kemi Badenoch saying that on our colleague Laura Koonsberg's show that he agreed with much of what she said and that parents would welcome a cross-party consensus around much bolder action. In recent days, both Wes Streeting and Keir Starmer appear to have moved somewhat in a direction sympathetic towards such a ban. Well, we're joined now by Catherine McKinnell, Labour MP for Newcastle North, one of the signatories of this open letter, and also Anna Edmondson, the NSPCC's Head of Policy. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Thank you both for so much. Oh, one of those lines isn't working very well. Which one is it? Catherine, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Fantastic. We'll just check the other line while we try and make sure we can hear Anna clearly as well. Catherine, if I could just start with you, just before we get into the pros and cons and what you set out in your letter, is your sense that the government is moving towards your view that a social media ban for under 16 is sort of becoming more of a priority for Keir Starmer's government?
Well, I think we've reached a point where something has to be done. Because we know, I mean, the figures are so clear, the impact it's having on children and the outcomes at school and at home and their well-being and all the referrals for mental health support. But I think what needs to happen is that parents and teachers as well themselves are crying out for help with this, because they feel that we're against, a really strong force. And actually being able to support children through this and navigate it, the tools that we've been using so far, I think we're losing this battle for children to have that great childhood, that great development, and to, yes, socialise, yes, engage, yes, engage with the world and understand how the online world works, but not to be monetized and profited from in the way that is happening at the moment.
That's your case for the ban, which you set out very clearly in the letter. Just on the political intel, if you like, just in terms of the people you're speaking to in the Parliamentary Labour Party and at the top of the government, is your sense that they are moving towards it, that we should expect in the coming days to hear more from the government on this?
Well, I hope so. I think the government are keen to make sure that children are protected. And I know that there's a lot that we did in the Department for Education to improve media literacy, bringing that into the curriculum, making sure that young people are equipped and understand how the online world works and can have the tools to navigate it safely. And to be honest, that's the approach I've taken to date, where I think, you know, the online world exists, children live in the world as it is, and we need to teach them and equip them to navigate it. But I've reached the conclusion that more needs to be done. I think it's the shift in the way the algorithms work and the addictive nature of social media that means action has to happen.
Well, let me put that to Anna Edmondson, who's the head of policy and public affairs at the NSPCC. Anna, morning. What do you think about this idea of whether or not there should be an outright ban on social media for under 16s?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with Catherine that something needs to be done. For a long time, NSPCC, alongside other organisations in this space, have been campaigning hard for children to be safe online. And that's because we see firsthand, day in, day out, through services like Childline, what impact it has on children when it goes wrong. But it's important that in that push to do something, which is absolutely necessary, that we don't put in place solutions that actually cause unintended consequences and make children and young people less safe, or cut them off from vital sources of support, or push them into even more dangerous spaces.
Are you talking about things like the dark web?
Well, it's more that if, as they've done in Australia, you choose a certain number of platforms and you say these are the platforms that you shouldn't be accessing, then there are other platforms that aren't caught by that. And that's where children and young people who have a desire to go online, they want to learn, they want to connect, they want to express themselves online, and they won't stop going online. It will simply push them to unsafe, less regulated spaces. And that's the bit that where the dangers really follow, because you have spaces where children feel they're doing something wrong. They have to hide their social media use from their parents and help. They're less likely to speak up. That's not safeguarding children. That is a potential gift to abusers.
Let me put that to you, Catherine McKinnell. So first of all, the argument from Anna Edmondson is that it won't work because it potentially exposes them to greater harms. And I wonder if you could also address the argument of some opponents of a ban, Catherine, who say that actually what this would amount to is a form of surveillance or censorship by either the state or by big tech.
Can I just be clear that there doesn't need to be an all or nothing approach to this? Like, young people can still spend time online. The internet is there. There is a huge world of information and opportunity there for young people and adults, and indeed an increasing number of adults, and particularly young adults who have come through their teens are turning away from social media in particular. And what we're talking about there is algorithmic driven content that you haven't asked for, you haven't looked for, but it's sent to you, and somebody, big tech companies, are making money
out. I'm so sorry, but I really want you to address, directly what Miss Edmondson just said. Sorry, because you made that point before and I totally hear it. But what Miss Edmondson said directly is that if you have a social media ban, such as they've enacted in Australia, you end up having to choose the companies that you're going to ban, and therefore there are other companies you can't possibly know, maybe because they don't exist yet, and therefore children might be attracted to those darker, more unregulated places and be exposed to greater danger.
Well, obviously Australia has taken the lead on this, and I think the world is watching. And I think it's important that we learn from what Australia has done. We look at what's working, we look at what isn't working. And I think there are lots of countries looking at how do we get this right. And I think, but picking particular companies it is a challenge. I've heard that said about the Australian ban. But I think this is about the principle of children's data being used by companies from a very young age, and money being made from that, from content being sent to children that then they haven't asked for and they haven't even looked for. It's being sent to them. And I think that's what needs to stop. Not children communicating with each other, sort of on online activity, looking up the news. The online world exists. It will still exist for children.
It will still be there for them.
But I think them being vulnerable to content being sent to them, I think there needs to be big changes made in that regard.
Catherine McKinnell from Labour MP for Newcastle North and Anna Edmondson from the NSPCC. Thank you.
It's 3 minutes to 8. Another aspect of the US takes centre stage later today.
How the American Revolution created the idea of a nation.
If you have a good idea, if you really want to do it, you can do it.
A 250-year struggle to fulfill the promises of the founding fathers.
Ronald Reagan came in and not only changed the policies, but kind of brought back the American spirit.
The gains for those who succeed at the top are getting bigger and richer, and the sustenance at the bottom and the middle is getting less and less.
Take an American journey with me, James Naughton.
It was tough just to get here.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, beginning this morning at 11.
Let's check the weather. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Anna. We've got a lot of low cloud, mist and fog around this morning, and some of us are going to see outbreaks of rain today. The wettest weather will be across Northern Ireland and also the Western Isles, the Isles of Scilly and into the far west of Cornwall. So here, a slow-moving weather front bringing outbreaks of rain that last through much of the day. We've also got a bit of rain further east. So if we look at the forecast across all of England, away from the southwest, it is going to be cloudy, that low cloud, mist and fog around this morning, and then patchy, drizzly outbreaks of rain on and off, but some sunny spells developing later in the afternoon for East Anglia and the southeast. The areas that are going to see the most sunshine today, though, are across the southwest of England, into Wales and central and eastern Scotland as well. Yes, some mist and some fog patches around, but once they clear away over the next few hours, you should see a few glimpses of blue sky. Temperatures today between about 5 to 11 degrees, so fairly average for the time of year. But low pressure moves in from the southwest tonight, and that's going to bring us a spell of particularly windy and wet weather for southern and western areas as we head into tomorrow.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Monday the 19th of January. The headlines this morning, at least 39 people have been killed in Spain's worst train crash for more than a decade, in circumstances described by the government as extremely strange. Sir Keir Starmer will lay out the UK's response to President Trump's tariff ultimatum on Greenland soon. The former Cabinet Secretary Lord Sedwill will join us to discuss it after the news. And volunteers in the UK are taking part in an international trial to see if a finger prick blood test can help diagnose Alzheimer's disease.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll discuss whether Netflix is dumbing down after the actor Matt Damon revealed how our shortening attention spans are changing the way that films are made.
You know, it wouldn't be terrible if you reiterated the plot 3 or 4 times in the dialogue because people are on their phones while they're watching, you know what I mean?
Carthy speaks to the British tennis number 2, Soné Kartal, ahead of her first round match at the Australian Open tonight, but her dad might not be watching.
Sometimes he has to leave because he gets too nervous, but even at home, he's kind of pacing up and down the house, shouting to my mum in another room, you know, what's the score, what's going on, because sometimes he can't watch either.
And Chris Packham and Glenn Matlock of the Sex Pistols on Punk at 50. We'll reflect on how punk music, if it is just music or something beyond, how it blew apart British culture and changed the world. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
At least 39 people are now known to have died in a collision between two high-speed trains in southern Spain. One of the trains derailed and hit an oncoming train outside the town of Adamuth near Córdoba. Dozens of people on board were injured, at least 24 of them seriously. Officials say the number of dead could rise. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez says his country has experienced a night of deep pain. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
One of the trains was travelling from Malaga to Atocha station here in the capital when it derailed about an hour into its journey, colliding with another train travelling in the opposite direction. A firefighter said retrieving people from the wreckage was difficult as carriages were twisted with passengers inside. One witness said one carriage had completely overturned. The mayor of Adamuth, Rafael Moreno, reached the scene soon after the accident. He described it as being like a nightmare. The transport minister, Oscar Puente, said the derailment was extremely strange given that it had not taken place on a curve and the line had been revamped only last year. An investigation has now begun into what happened, although it's not expected to report back for at least a month. Spain's high-speed rail network is one of the largest in the world and is admired around Europe. This is the worst rail accident in the country since 80 people died in 2013 in a crash near Santiago de Compostela.
A freelance Spanish journalist, Clara Nuno, told us a lack of information about the total number of dead is causing concern.
One thing that the people that are working in the rescue of the trains right now there, while the sun is rising right now in Spain, they say they can hear the phones from people are calling the family members, so they can hear the phones, are the sounding of the phones from inside the trains. But the people, of course, is not picking up the phones. So this is a very delicate situation right now.
Sir Keir Starmer is to make a statement in Downing Street this morning to outline the government's response to President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on countries opposing his takeover of Greenland. The Prime Minister has already spoken on the phone to Mr. Trump, saying it's wrong to target NATO allies in this way. Make UK, which represents British manufacturers, told this programme it was a time for cool heads. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
Government sources say Sir Keir is holding the hastily arranged news conference because he believes voters, and in particular businesses, need to understand how his government plans to respond to the possibility of 10% tariffs in less than a fortnight. The Prime Minister is expected to reiterate today what he told Donald Trump in a phone call yesterday, that applying tariffs on allies for pursuing the collective security of NATO is completely wrong. Opposition parties have been united in condemning the White House's threat. The Liberal Democrats have gone further than most in calling for retaliatory tariffs and other measures which they say will hit Trump and his cronies where it hurts. President Trump is taking a large US delegation to the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos this week. Sir Keir is not currently planning to attend, but Number 10 sources have said it is possible that could change.
A European Union diplomat says the bloc is committed to a diplomatic solution with the United States, but plans are also being drawn up for retaliatory action, as our Europe editor Katja Adler reports from Brussels.
The EU is considering imposing €93 billion worth of tariffs on the United States, or restricting the access of American companies to the bloc's single market, if Donald Trump makes good on his promise to impose tariffs on any country that gets in the way of his takeover of Greenland, a territory of Denmark. The EU's retaliatory measures are being prepared to give Brussels leverage in talks with the US president in Davos this week, where the EU hopes to reach some kind of compromise. France and Germany's finance ministers meet in Berlin today to establish a joint position. With transatlantic defence and economic relations hanging in the balance, EU leaders say they'll meet in Brussels for an emergency summit, probably on Thursday.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has accused the US of exercising power outside the norms of international law. In an interview with this programme, he also calls for significant changes to the UN Security Council, as our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports.
The Security Council is the most powerful body at the United Nations, with the US, China, Russia, France and the UK as permanent members. But Antonio Guterres said it was now ineffective and no longer represented the world that existed today. The Council's composition, he said, should be changed to regain its legitimacy. He also said the power of permanent members to veto decisions should be limited. Some, he said, were using their veto to frustrate the will of a huge number of UN members in ways that were very difficult to swallow. In recent years, the US has vetoed decisions on Gaza, Russia on Ukraine. After the attack on Venezuela and threats against Greenland, Mr. Guterres accused the US of disrespecting international law and dismissing multilateral solutions as irrelevant. He also criticised the US for seeking quick ceasefires that did not last because the root causes of conflict were not addressed.
Official figures show China's economy grew by 5% last year, meeting the target set by the President Xi Jinping. The country's long-running property crisis is continuing to affect domestic spending. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
China's economy is proving to be resilient, although some economists believe its actual growth in 2025 was slower than official data suggests. The key to the country's growth lies in exports and finding new markets outside the United States after Donald Trump imposed tariffs on Chinese goods. Beijing still has serious domestic challenges. A slump in the property market has many households curbing their spending. Local governments are deep in debt and youth unemployment remains stubbornly high. China has also recorded the lowest birth rate on record in 2025, despite huge government incentives to encourage more couples to have children.
An international trial is underway to see if the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease can be detected in a test that requires just a few drops of blood. The study involves 1,000 volunteers across the UK, Canada and the US. It will compare the results of finger prick blood testing with specialised brain scans, which are time-consuming and expensive. Our medical editor, Fergus Walsh, has more.
Diagnosing Alzheimer's from a blood sample is a technology that is rapidly coming of age. It analyses so-called blood-based biomarkers, which show the presence of rogue proteins in the brain that can accumulate 15 years before the first symptoms of the disease are seen. There's already one US-approved blood test for Alzheimer's, which involves a traditional blood draw using a needle and syringe. The finger prick test involves just a few drops of blood and could potentially be done at home and posted to a clinic for analysis. The study is being led by the medical research charity LifeArc, which said, if successful, it could lead to a cost-effective screening program for Alzheimer's.
Ministers have abandoned the final debate and vote in the Commons on draft legislation for what's known as the Hillsborough Law. This would create a legal obligation for public authorities to tell the truth to inquiries. Some Labour MPs and campaigners had been pushing for it to fully apply to the security services. The government says the bill needs to be handled correctly to keep the country safe, and it will now work with all parties to strengthen the legislation. Prince Harry's civil case against the publisher of the Daily Mail for allegedly gathering information by unlawful means is expected to get underway at the High Court in London. The Duke of Sussex is among a number of public figures who are suing Associated Newspapers Limited. The company has denied the allegations. Helena Wilkinson reports.
The Duke of Sussex is expected to attend the trial at the High Court and give evidence later this week. He's one of seven complainants: Sir Elton John, the actress Elizabeth Hurley, and Baroness Doreen Lawrence, the mother of Stephen Lawrence, who was murdered, are among the group. They accuse Associated Newspapers Limited of grave breaches of privacy by gathering information about them by unlawful means. The claims include the hiring of private investigators to bug homes, to engage in phone hacking, and to dishonestly gather medical and financial information. ANL has strongly denied what it says are lurid and preposterous allegations. The case is expected to last 9 weeks.
That was Helena Wilkinson.
Alan, thank you. Alan, thank you so much. The time now is 10 past 8. America's PBS News has obtained a letter from President Trump to the Norwegian Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, forwarded by the US National Security Council staff to multiple European ambassadors in Washington. This has been confirmed by Shashank Joshi, the defense editor of The Economist. Here is the letter from Donald Trump to the Norwegian Prime Minister, which was published or released on the internet a few hours ago now. Here is that letter in its entirety. Dear Jonas, considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8 wars, plus I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace, although it will always be predominant, but can now think about what is good and proper for the United States of America. Denmark cannot protect that land from Russia or China. And why do they have a quote-unquote right of ownership anyway? There are no written documents. It's only that a boat landed there hundreds of years ago. But we had boats landing there also. I have done more for NATO than any other person since its founding, and now NATO should be doing something for the United States. The world is not secure unless we have complete and total control of Greenland. Thank you, President DJT. In an hour, the Prime Minister here, Sir Keir Starmer, is giving a press conference about that situation and will no doubt address the contents of that letter to the Norwegian Prime Minister. Chris Mason is our political editor and joins us now. Chris, an unusual moment this, some might say, but we're getting used to unusual moments. What might the Prime Minister say and what kind of bind is he in?
Yeah, morning to you. Just listening to you reading that letter, we're reminded, aren't we, of the words that we so often reach for in commentary around President Trump. Astonishing, extraordinary, and yet exclamations are so often found wanting, really, because they seem so banal, because they are used so often. For the Prime Minister, this is, what, the third Monday of 2026, the second where he was intending to be out and about, talking to a domestic audience about domestic concerns, not least the cost of living. A couple of weeks ago, it was Reading, and all the questions were about Venezuela. Today, the visit cancelled. Instead, he is in Downing Street, as you say, this news conference in the next hour or so. He will repeat his view that this idea around tariffs connected to Europe's stance on Greenland is completely wrong. I think we'll hear quite a bit about what he sees as the benefits of the relationship with the United States economically and on security grounds. There's a sense in Downing Street that Number 10 maintain a relationship with the president that some of the European leaders don't have. The Prime Minister's conversation with the president last night followed a sequence of calls with European allies and indeed with NATO. It is noted that President Macron of France has been talking about bazookas, talking about retaliatory tariffs. We won't get that kind of language from the Prime Minister. The open question remains, Amol, does he, the Prime Minister, dash to Davos, to the World Economic Forum in the snow in Switzerland later this week? Why is that a live question? Well, Donald Trump will be there. And will there be a sense within a couple of days that a delegation of European leaders seeing the President in the flesh face to face might be useful?
Brief thought, Chris. It is, you know, when he did this these interviews over the course of the Christmas period and New Year, saying that he wanted this to be the year where growth comes back, people start feeling better off, it is proving quite hard, maybe not for any reason to do with his own shortcomings, but it's proving quite hard for the Prime Minister to really lay out the argument that people most want to hear from him on, which is what this is going to do in terms of those domestic priorities.
Completely, because he is drowned out perpetually by a colossal megaphone from Washington. And it's happened for much of the last 12 months since the inauguration. There's every expectation it will continue to happen. And against a domestic backdrop that, as we regularly report on the programme, is incredibly difficult for the Prime Minister, as it was indeed for the previous Prime Minister, whenever he attempts to make some headway in terms of making that domestic argument, it is so often drowned out. I think this morning he will attempt to make the best of the situation, to say that the international picture and the domestic one are intertwined, and to focus on the international helps deliver on the domestic. But the reality is, politically, he would have much rather been outside of London in the company of folk who are wrestling with all of the things we so often talk about on this programme around bills and the cost of living. And instead, it's the geopolitical picture, with every likelihood that that continues to be the case for quite some time.
Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you very much.
Let's get the thoughts of Lord Sedwill, who was National Security Advisor between 2017 and 2020. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also got a statement just in the last hour, a slightly different tone. This one's from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, which says China stated its position on the Greenland issue on multiple occasions. International law, based on the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, is the foundation of the current international order and must be upheld. We urge the United States to stop using the so-called China threat as an excuse to pursue its own interests. Very much reflecting what we were hearing from Antonio Guterres early in the programme. How realistic do you think the threat to the US from not owning Greenland is?
Well, I think striking in that letter that Amol just read out, that he talked about control of Greenland and not necessarily annexing Greenland. And I think, you know, what is clear, and the government, British government, set this out clearly, quite clear from Denmark as well, is if the conversation is about defence, security, economic investment in Greenland and interests in Greenland and excluding China and Russia, that's a conversation that can be had with the Trump administration. If it's about the annexation of Greenland without the consent of the people of Greenland, then that is completely unacceptable. You know, let's not forget, over 40 years ago, we fought a war in the Falklands on exactly that principle. But if it's about security, defence, economic access, there's a conversation to be had. And I hope the Prime Minister this morning in his statement, obviously, as you've said, and Chris Mason just said, he'll be talking about the economic impact on the UK and trying to reassure business how we're going to respond and so on. But I hope he will also use it as an opportunity to address Washington. You know, there's a very important audience in Washington here, not only the Democrats, but the many Republicans who are deeply uneasy about the recklessness of the way the Trump administration is proceeding, who know that China and Russia are the beneficiaries of this row, and who we must hope can be encouraged to rein in President Trump.
We've seen a notably muted response from European leaders when President Trump does something like this. And the idea is supposed to be that they're doing it to maintain good relationships. But when something like this happens and that the tariffs are slapped on, you wonder how effective that strategy has actually been.
I mean, clearly, yeah, we had in the UK, we were very pleased with a successful state visit, with a trade deal that gave us a better position on tariffs than most of our competitors. And President Trump has just torn that up because he's unhappy with us on a different policy issue. And we have to accept that is the world we're in with this president, that he will apply measures in order to, and leverage in order to try to secure his objectives. And I'm afraid that means we are in a period where there's going to be a great deal of business uncertainty and so on over this. Because even if we sort this row out, we don't know whether there'll be another one. Now, the US Supreme Court may well decide that President Trump does not have the power to simply impose tariffs on a whim. The US Constitution, US law doesn't really suggest that he does. Let's see what the Supreme Court says. But I think the Europeans are actually proceeding quite wisely, because this isn't just about President Trump. You know, getting into a slanging match with him isn't a smart tactic, not only with him, because it will simply inflame him, but because it can also make it harder for those voices in the US political system who are seeking to restrain him to actually get some leverage over the administration. So speaking softly and carrying a big stick, a famous American president, Teddy Roosevelt's line, is perhaps the right approach for the Europeans as well.
So you don't think just now that the moment is right for the Prime Minister to say to himself, there are things that need to be said and I'm going to say them?
I think he should. No, he should be direct about that, because, as I said, he needs to address that audience in Washington, who, not just President Trump himself, and I think it would be wise for the Prime Minister to try and see him in Davos if he can, but he must speak over the head of President Trump into the political establishment in Washington and remind them, for example, that after 9/11, the UK and Denmark came to the aid of the United States and indeed incurred a higher rate of casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan than the Americans did themselves, and make the case that the alliance is in America's interest. President Trump likes to suggest the alliance is solely the Americans looking after the rest of us, and it isn't. It's an alliance which protects our collective security. It's important we make that argument. He may not listen to it. Members of his administration undoubtedly know it, but more importantly, the wider political establishment in Washington, who are deeply uneasy about the recklessness here, the advantage this is giving to China and Russia, those people who can restrain him are encouraged to do so. And I hope the Prime Minister is speaking to them as well as to British business and the British public.
Just as a final thought, this endless flux, and much of it, as we've said, driven by Donald Trump and what he has to say, is enormously exhausting. It's politically exhausting. It's economically exhausting. It's taking away resources and time for people who really should be focusing on other things. Is there any way that we can mitigate that?
We just have to navigate it, I'm afraid. I mean, you're absolutely right. It does suck the oxygen out of many other things. As you were saying, the Prime Minister was hoping to spend a day on domestic issues. The last thing NATO needs right now, while the war in Ukraine is continuing, is this row over Greenland. But there are other things that the UK and the other European members of NATO can do. And in particular, in my view, should be accelerating those commitments on defence, not just expenditure, but integration, greater interoperability of European NATO, in order to demonstrate, again, not just to Trump, but to the American political constituency, that we take security and defence seriously. And we're prepared to use our resources and do our part. And again, I'd like to see the Prime Minister start that conversation with our public, because, of course, that involves hard choices.
Lord Sedwell, thanks for your time this morning.
22 minutes past eight. Many a fan and historian argue that this year, punk turns 50 years old. It was, after all, November 1976, when a song that was released in the UK went, well, like this. For many, perhaps millions of Britons, punk changed them forever. But what was punk, really? A People's History of Punk is a new Radio 4 and BBC Sound series. It starts tomorrow on Radio 4 at 4pm. It is presented by a proud punk in Chris Packham, who joins us now, as does Glenn Matlock, bass guitarist for the Sex Pistols. Chris and Glenn, good morning.
Good morning.
Wonderful to have you with us. Chris, what was punk?
Punk was more about an attitude than just the music. It was an opportunity for a generation of young people to challenge authority in a very creative way and generate a broader awareness of not just that changing musical scene, but everything within fashion, art, broader culture, politics as well. It was an awakening and an empowering moment for many of us, which left a lasting impact in our lives and has been guiding us ever since. It was a very much a do-it-yourself and never take no for an answer attitude, which was instilled and has stayed.
How did punk change your life, Chris?
Well, I was an undiagnosed autistic teenager really struggling, and it gave me a means of identifying myself as different when I was coming to terms with that. But it also gave me the opportunity to entertain a broader awareness of society, something that I'd otherwise locked myself away with. The rise of the far right at the time was a real concern, and it made me want to stand up and change the world, and it empowered me to think that I could do so. The first protest that I ever went to was Rock Against Racism in 1978. We were tired of the racist attitudes at the time and all of the homophobia and misogyny, and we wanted to make the world a better place, and we've been trying hard ever since to do so.
Glenn, when you and the Pistols came together in 1974 with Malcolm McLaren, who's 10 years older than you, what were you trying to do? Were you trying to change the world, take the establishment on and so forth, or were you just trying to write cool songs and have a blast?
A little bit of both, I think, really. We were fed up with what was going on musically at the time. Although, having said that, we did come through on the tail end of the glam rock thing, which had kind of been and gone. But there were some pretty cool things in that. Lou Reed with his Transformer album with Bowie and the end of the Spiders from Mars and stuff. But they kind of been and gone. You know, they had some success and moved elsewhere, and we were left with the detritus of people like Barclay James Arvis singing about kind of obgoblins and things like that. Didn't mean much to a kid from the Outer Road like me, or Steve and Paul from West London, or John in Finsbury Park. So there was a little bit of both, and there was a lot going on, as is today, you know, plus ça change with the rise of the far right. And I think we were just trying to somehow navigate our way through all of that and have a laugh, stir things up a little bit.
And do you worry, Glenn, that punks are sometimes typecast or in danger of being misunderstood? And if they are misunderstood, what do you think people get wrong about punks?
Well, like there's a lot of stuff these days that I don't quite understand about punk myself. It became a very broad church. There's a long way from the Sex Pistols to the Talking Heads and from the Slits to the Dolly Mixers or something like that, musically. But also, I think a lot of punks got the wrong end of the stick, and maybe some of the main... progenitors of it did as well. So it's kind of weird these days. You know, I'm constantly surprised how many punks I see on my Facebook thing. You're kind of pro-Trump. It's a bit weird.
Well, on that business of, well, I mean, Chris, you used the term far right. What was, just remind maybe some of our younger listeners, Chris, what was the infiltration, so we say, or the attendance of the far right, the National Front, as was in the 1970s? And what echoes do you see and worry about today, Chris?
Well, there was widespread racism in media and in our general lives, and it wasn't something that we were, you know, aware of until it was kind of sort of pointed out. And it wasn't just the racism that was there. There were all sorts of other social inequalities. I mean, the mid-70s were a pretty tough time. 3-day weeks, ongoing strikes, you know, two governments within a year. So there was political instability there. It was tough being a teenager. I remember my careers talk was, if you don't get to sixth form college, have you thought about joining the services? So the outlook could be quite bleak for a lot of working class kids like myself. And when you went to the gigs here, that the music was a focal point, there's no doubt about that, because the electrifying nature. I mean, Amal, I simply can't tell you what it was like to stand in one of those gigs. The sense of immediate euphoria, the uplifting nature of it, the energy was palpable. We could have powered the UK with the Sex Pistols for several months in 1976 and 77. You know, that's what it was like. And for many young people, it gave them an outlet and an opportunity to be themselves and to instigate those changes and rectify those wrongs. I mean, ultimately, of course, some aspects of the far right tried to infiltrate the punk movement, and that generated animosity there. And there's no doubt the gigs were violent at times, but that edge, that energy, and that determination has stayed with so many of us. And that's what the series explores.
Yeah. Glenn, where is that energy today? Rebellious guitar music. Where do you still think there's that energy sort of circulating around? Does it find expression?
I don't think it is. I mean, I've got two sons who are kind of working musician ages. They're musicians, and they're having a go at doing it. I think the problem is that the media and the record companies have had so much practice over the years of shutting things out that are kind of a bit more pushing it a little bit. And I think it's become quite sort of vacuous what we do get to hear on the radio. Not all the time, but, you know, there you go. But then a few people that come through, you know, even like the kneecap people, whatever you feel about them, at least they're pushing it a bit, you know. So,
all right, Glenn, very good to talk to you. Bass guitarist and the Sex Pistols. Chris Packham, thank you so much. And I should say that A People's History of Punk, yeah, it's on BBC Radio 4 tomorrow at 4 p.m. and also on BBC Sounds.
I have, at 29 minutes past 8, a small update for you on our Today's Babies series. We're following three families who are having their first child at the start of 2026. And we're going to do it for the next 5 years because we know that the early years are crucial to the healthy development of children. So what we'll do with this series is try and shine a light, really, on the very different experiences and outcomes that families have across the UK. And the news is that the first of our Today's Babies has been born. Well, it's two, actually. It's the twins, Ruby and Ezra is what they've been called. They were born on the 14th of January and their parents, Alita and Adam, sent us the news over the weekend. They're all doing well, mum and babies too. We send them, of course, all of the best wishes from us and from you, and we look forward to hearing more about them on the programme very soon.
Indeed, and huge congratulations. 29 minutes past 8, Carthy is here with the sport. Hi, Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. Melbourne is the place to be for live sport this morning. The current Wimbledon champion, Iga Swiatek, is playing her first round match at the Australian Open against the qualifier, Yue Yuan, who's taken a 2-1 lead in the first set. Novak Djokovic starts his Australian Open campaign later today. The British number 3, Jacob Fernley, has just been defeated 3-1 by Poland's Kamil Mrysiak, and earlier this morning, Fran Jones had to retire from her match with an injury. Later tonight, the British number 2, 2022, Sonia Cartel will play her first round match against the 31st seed Anna Kalinskaya. Last year, it was Cartel's first season on the WTA Tour, and I've been speaking to her about her slightly unconventional tennis style and how pushing herself to play in the highest level of tournaments has helped her rise from just inside the top 1,000 to her current position as the world number 66.
I kind of wanted to get used to what did it feel like week in, week out for the body to play at the best level, and also mentally, what was it like? So it was a conscious effort to do that last year and just made myself as comfortable being uncomfortable as I could. And I think that set me up perfectly for this year.
And now you are ready for a Grand Slam. You've been to the fourth round at Wimbledon last year. What does that add now to how you can play the Australian Open with a slightly different mindset, I guess?
Yeah, I think obviously I'm playing the better opponents now and I'm playing on the bigger courts, and obviously Wimbledon last year was a huge, obviously, first and a huge achievement for me. And also Indian Wells as well was another one. So I think I had snippets throughout the year where I kind of really felt like I do have the level. It's just bringing that consistency.
Have there been standout moments for you off the court over the last year?
I'm getting a lot more attention maybe back home now. I'm noticing kind of the younger kids, and that aspect I think has been the most eye-opening for me. If I'm at my club, for example, when I was back home during Christmas, I'm getting kids playing like their first national event and they're asking me for advice, and it's just realizing that the kids are looking up to you and inspired by what you've done.
Yeah, you work closely with the LTA, don't you, on going back to your old school. You still play at your local club that you grew up at. You are with your coaches that were with you through childhood. How important is that aspect for you to just keep things the same as they always were?
I haven't changed anything. There have definitely been times where people were saying maybe you need kind of more advice and people that have done this before. And I think for me, you know, I didn't want to change something that was working. And yeah, like, I get on super well with Ben, my coach, and spend a lot of time with him, and he probably knows me better than probably anyone. It's special for me that we're both doing kind of this journey together. I love my club, and I think what the kids, one of the things they were saying and I'm trying to get across, you don't have to be incredible junior number one at a super young age to be able to be where I am today. They can realize that there is no right or wrong way to do this crazy tennis journey.
Yeah, well, I've interviewed you quite a lot over the last couple of years, and it is really obvious that you have your own style, whether it's the tennis or the tattoos, the way you dress, your physique. And I'm not being rude, I'm the same height as you. But, you know, how important is it that you do those things in that way?
You know, I haven't been graced with height advantage, unfortunately. So I think you have to adapt, you have to find your strengths and work around that. And I think that's something I did growing up. I knew I wasn't going to be the tallest, so I had to make sure that I was super fast and super strong. There are going to be people that are taller than me and stronger than me. They're going to hit a bigger ball. My tennis journey doesn't really follow the stereotypical tennis journey, and I think neither do I, really, to be honest.
It might not be the stereotypical tennis journey, but you are the British number two. You've known the British number one, Emma Raducanu, I think, since you were about 9 or 10 years old. When Emma won the US Open, I think, were you outside the top 1,000 then? And now you're just right behind her in the rankings. Is it helpful having that challenge from Emma and also from the likes of Katie Bolter and the others?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of British girls now that are doing amazing in the sport. And I think it's the first time in years that we've had so many that are clustered and all pretty close to each other on the ranking wise. So, of course, it is a bit of friendly competition. And it's nice to have people are kind of coming for your spot. So you're pushing yourself. And I think it does motivate you to try and find the next level.
It was your parents, I think, who got you involved in tennis. Your dad, I think, is a big fan of watching all tennis. Is he able to watch you live or on television? Which does he prefer?
I'm not sure he prefers either. I think he gets super stressed. He came to Wimbledon last year, which was a first. He managed to stay through every single one of my matches, which was something that he's never been able to master. Sometimes he has to leave because he gets too nervous. But even at home, he's kind of pacing up and down the house, shouting to my mum in another room, you know, what's the score? What's going on? Because sometimes he can't watch either. But my mum is obviously back home in London, but I think she's probably jet lagged as well.
Well, I hope to have several matches to watch in Australia. Good luck at the Australian Open. Thanks for talking to us, Sonia.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully good news tomorrow morning about Sonia Cartel. A couple of other headlines for you. Senegal beat Morocco 1-0 to lift the Africa Cup of Nations trophy for the second time in a chaotic final in Rabat. And Kyron Wilson won his first Masters snooker title, beating John Higgins by 10 frames to 6.
Carthy, thank you very much indeed. It's 26 minutes to 9, and just after 9 o'clock, Tom Sutcliffe will be starting the week for us. What have you got, Tom?
Morning, Emil. I'm doing this programme. You may have noticed that people aren't terribly happy with the current state of politics. Subtle signs, but you're an expert. Can democracy, though, as it's currently constituted, deliver anything better? With us this morning are the writer Phil Tinline, making the case for politicians getting a lot less fearful about using the power they have and maybe trying to claw back a bit more. The political scientist Helen Landamore, who thinks that ordinary citizens picked at random could do a better job. And in the corner for old-fashioned career politicians, a notable one, Michael Gove. That's Start the Week on power and its powerlessness, just after nine.
Good stuff. Thank you, Tom. It is 25 to 9 now. The weather today, cloudy for many of us. There'll be some patchy rain around, but it should be a little brighter in West and South East England, Scotland and Wales.
It is 25 to 9 time for, well, you're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan. Time for a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
At least 39 people are now known to have died in a collision between two trains in southern Spain. Dozens of people on board were injured, at least 24 of them seriously. One government minister has described the circumstances of the crash as extremely strange. Sir Keir Starmer is due to make a statement in Downing Street in the next hour to set out the government's response to President Trump's proposal to impose tariffs on countries opposing his takeover of Greenland. The European Union has been holding its own talks on the crisis, including possible retaliatory measures against the United States, although officials have said they will try to dissuade Mr. Trump from pressing ahead with his threat. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told this programme changes need to be made to the Security Council. The power to veto resolutions should be limited, he says, and the composition of the council changed to help regain its legitimacy. And China says its economy grew by 5% last year, meeting its annual growth target. However, it's one of the lowest rates in decades.
Thank you, Alan. Now, an hour ago, you heard our exclusive interview with the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And one of the topics that I asked him about was the violent repression of protesters in Iran, which is a UN member. Thousands of people were killed on the streets by regime forces. But because of the difficulty in getting information out of the country, it is hard to know exactly how many. Here is part of that conversation with the Secretary General. You've said that you are deeply concerned about the violent repression that's been happening in Iran, regime forces killing protesters in large numbers. In fact, the regime wrote to you just a few days ago and they were asking you to confirm and support narratives that they were not behind that violence. They were asking you to condemn the US. What is your view and what is your assessment? Because, of course, it's very difficult to know how many people have been killed, how terrible those atrocities have been.
We have no reliable information about exactly what has happened, but it is obvious that we witnessed a level of repression that is totally unacceptable, with violations of human rights that we cannot accept. That doesn't mean that we believe that in such situations other countries should go there and bomb or should start a war because of that, because then the world will enter into absolute chaos and international law will be completely trampled.
You touched on this, but do you feel that potential US military intervention in Iran could make things worse for people there?
I don't think it would change anything. I don't think it's with military interventions that we change things. But I think that all the pressure should be put in Iran to make sure that this violations of human rights are not repeated.
Well, Lise Doucette is our chief international correspondent. Morning, Lise.
Good morning.
He talked about putting pressure on Iran, but of course, in that interview earlier, he admitted that the pressure that the UN can bring to bear on its members has been seriously compromised nowadays and barely exists in some cases. We know, as we were saying there, that the number of protesters killed is significant. Where are we with working out exactly what happened and what that true number might be?
It is still really hard to get an exact number. And in some ways, the exact number doesn't matter. Of course, it matters to the countless numbers of families who, some of them don't even have their loved ones back. They don't know where they are. And sometimes they're being forced to barter to pay money to retrieve the body of their loved ones. Even the senior officials in the Islamic Republic of Iran have confirmed, even the supreme leader has confirmed, that it is in the thousands. Iran is still under a partial blackout. Some of the websites are coming back. The internet has been partly restored. You can make telephone calls at least out. It will be some time before we have a clearer idea, but we do know that it is unprecedented, even by the measure of the other times where the Iranian authorities used lethal force to put down protests.
And as this story, I mean, inevitably, Lise, if we don't see any military action from the United States, this story will start to fade from the headlines once again, not from the gaze of you and our colleagues at BBC Persian, but what do we think will happen next? It's very difficult to predict, but what is on the table?
No one can unsee what they've seen on the ground. The Iranians can't undo what they have done. They, even though the use of unprecedented force and this blackout has pulled that roar from the streets calling for change, Iran is now a different country and it is a different regime in place. And you can't change that. The world waits now, and sadly, it is a measure of this time. And you've been hearing, our listeners have been hearing about it throughout this program, listening to the poor Antonio Guterres, who, to use the phrase, is now more secretary than general, you know, Sir Keir Starmer. Everyone is waiting to see what President Trump will do next. Military options are not off the table. He has said, as he often does, he likes to win and he wants to win the end game in Iran. And nobody is really clear what is his end game in Iran, but we can perhaps take a hint from what happened in Venezuela. It wasn't about regime change. It wasn't about democracy. He was in a short, sharp, and yes, successful strike, of course, widely condemned at the UN Security Council for a violation of international law. But he did get Nicolas Maduro out. He's now musing about how when the United States assassinated the Al-Quds leader, Qasem Soleimani, how the Iranian leader, and also Baghdadi, the first leader of the Islamic State, everyone said, oh, there'll be too many consequences, and he got away with it. So is he going to try to go after the supreme leader of Iran? What is he going to do? The protesters are also waiting. He told them, I'm going to help you, and he didn't.
Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, thank you.
18 minutes to nine. How is artificial intelligence changing the experience of university in this country and beyond? Well, during our Christmas guest editor series, you may recall that the historian Tom Holland gave his view that hallucinations in AI will prove tricky for academics and historians to deal with.
I wanted to know whether a particular element in the story of Jason of the Argonauts that had appeared in the 3rd century BC had been present in a poet called Pindar who was writing in the 5th century BC. And I was fairly confident that this element hadn't been in Pindar's poetry, but I thought, well, I'll just try out on AI. And AI said, oh yeah, Pindar was all over it. And I said, really? And it said, yeah, here is the poetry. It was lines of poetry. And I thought, oh God. How did I not know about this? So I went and looked it up in my copy of Pindar. It wasn't there. I ended up going to the British Library, ordering out every single copy of Pindar, and it wasn't there. And so I messaged a friend who's a specialist on Pindar and said, what's going on? Where is this stuff? He said, oh, it's hallucinations.
It's hallucinations. Well, interestingly, today, the University of Manchester is announcing a major deal with Microsoft, really the first of its kind, in which all 65,000 students and staff will be given access to Copilot. Copilot is Microsoft's AI companion, they say, to inform, entertain and inspire. We're joined now by Duncan Iverson, President and Vice-Chancellor of the University of Manchester, and he's on the line now. Good morning, Mr. Iverson.
Morning, Amal.
Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you. Why have you signed this deal?
So look, it's about equipping our staff and students with access to one of the most powerful technologies of the day. But as Tom was saying, it's also about giving them a chance to critically engage with it. It's not about giving students access to an autopilot. It's about Copilot. It's about how you engage with the technology. We know that our students will need to know how to use and develop skills around technology. That's always been the case with education. So first of its kind in the world, first of its kind in the UK, certainly. So it's a really exciting day for us.
Let's just go through some of the concerns. I mean, did your fellow academic staff raise any of the concerns? I mean, some of them quite familiar, some of them less so. But did your kind of fellow senior members at the University of Manchester say maybe this is not such a good idea? Because you'll know that you're a professor of political philosophy yourself. There are lots and lots of academics who are very concerned about the intrusion of AI.
Yeah, so we're having a really good debate about the role of AI in both our teaching and research. But where else but a university can we have those debates? And where else can we test both the possibilities of the technology but also the limits? So yeah, we're having those debates. But look, the digital divide is a really important issue. Students should have equal access to the technology, whether they're from Rochdale, whether they're from Shanghai, whether they're from London. This gives our students access to the technology that they can use, test, use in critical ways, use it in ways that are actually going to push and really challenge how the technology is used and deployed. We know they need it as they enter the labor market, as they enter the job market, but they also need it as citizens, right? We can't bury our heads in the sand. So it's about a critical engagement with the technology above all.
So how do you think through the worry that some academics have about AI being essentially a replacement for thinking? In other words, people doing essays provided by any one of the chatbots that are now commercially available. How do you mitigate that in the context where you've given access to Microsoft Copilot?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. It's something we're thinking a lot about. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, when the web became something that academics were thinking about and people were worried about it then. So technology's always presented challenges to education. We have to help our students and our staff think about both the possibilities of technology, but also the limits. Let me give you an example. One thing we ask our students often to do, and our researchers do it, is a literature review, a survey of all the existing literature on a particular topic, on a disease, or on a historical episode, as Tom Holland was saying. AI does that very quickly now in a way that would have taken hours before, but you can't take it as gospel. So we're going to be asking our students to challenge the sources that, for example, the AI tools are using, test them, see if they make sense, and not just take it as something that they can go away and think is the truth. They've got to think critically about the technology.
And do you worry at all about AI as a substitute for human relationships? You'll be aware, closely aware, of this extraordinary figures around about a loneliness crisis in the UK, and it's flipped. The really interesting thing is it used to be that the older you are, the more lonely you are. Now it's the younger you are, the more lonely you are. And lots of people think that technology is one of the drivers of that. There are stories and we see every single day about how people have engaged in really dark relationships with chatbots and so on. How do you mitigate that, given that universities so much about forging great new relationships?
So I just think universities are the place where that critical approach is most likely to happen. It's not going to happen within tech companies alone. It's not going to happen with people sitting in their houses or their apartments alone. It's going to happen in environments where researchers, students are actually testing the technology. So we know, for example, that we're using technology around issues to do with mental health and access to clinical services. But at the same time, we have researchers asking hard questions, as you said, about how technology actually encourages, in some cases, loneliness. Or alienation or a sense of not belonging. So a university is the kind of place where you can have these critical conversations. You can't ignore it.
And can I ask you finally about whether or not there's been a decline in the standard of students coming in? I know it's a harsh thing for someone with your senior position to say, but there was a very interesting long read that the New Yorker did over the summer where they suggested that the first generation who went through sixth form with, for instance, ChatGPT is arriving at universities, particularly in some subjects like the humanities, just not prepared as they once were for university.
Look, I think that's a vast overgeneralization. You know, we're not seeing that in the students coming to Manchester. And, you know, the humanities, we probably never needed the humanities more than in the time of ChatGPT. And that's what we're trying to do at Manchester.
Okay. Professor Duncan Iverson, President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Manchester. Thank you so much for joining us.
Over on Radio 3 just now, you can hear the finale from Beethoven's Choral Symphony with its triumphant, life-affirming ode to joy. It is the perfect thing to listen to because I hadn't realised today is Blue Monday. Apparently the day when we're all feeling a bit miserable and fed up, so a bit of ode to joy will make that a bit better for you, hopefully.
Certainly will. 12 minutes to 9. A thundering great ship, seven tons of steel, fire and noise, has just docked in Amsterdam on stage. It's the opening night of Sting's musical, The Last Ship, an elegy to the Tyne's shipbuilding past and a love letter to the community that built it. Sting started writing it more than a decade ago. It's a story of love, pride, and the fight to finish the vessel that looms over the cast and the audience alike. Now the show is preparing to set sail far beyond the Netherlands with tours planned across Europe, Australia, and the United States. And Jim Naughty went to see it.
Some of the songs in The Last Ship were written more than 10 years ago, and it is a piece of work vast in scale on the stage that's still being built like the ship at its heart. Additions and deletions by Sting himself happening all the time. I joined an enthusiastic Amsterdam audience in the Royal Theatre Carré, from where it will travel across Europe and to Australia and the United States, where they were seeing a musical in the grand style and having a full-on Geordie experience.
On the earth or in heaven or another sun, when the last ship.
I spoke to Sting in his dressing room.
Normally when I play with my band, we hardly use any production. We just use lights and sound and three guys on the stage. So this, I think, for the first time, actually reproduces the epic scale of a shipyard, which I was born next to. And one of my earliest memories is seeing a giant ship at the end of the street, you know.
Which blocked out the sun, didn't it?
It certainly did. That was the early part of my life. And then we moved to the high street where it was the main road to the shipyard. So I'd watched thousands of men walk into work every morning at 7 o'clock, hearing that buzzer. And I would think as a kid, is that what I'm supposed to do? I did not want that. It was a terrifying place, dangerous, noisy. And so I did everything in my power to escape that. I passed the 11 plus.
Well, and the story is well known. Trying to escape it, and yet it's a life and a tradition and a solidarity of community that you're celebrating in this piece.
You know, having had a successful international career, I think I got to the age of 40 and I started to recognize what a gift my community and my upbringing was. You know, the very powerful symbolism of ships and the river and the sea and the church and the community spirit, that work ethic that people had. It's a story that hadn't been told about my town, and so I thought I owe a debt to this community somehow.
In 1859, the engineer Brunel will build the greatest ship afloat and rule the ocean swell. 19,000 tons of steel they used to shape the mighty keel. It's forged inside the smelter where they made the gates of hell. And the name upon the contract is Imbert Brunel.
Let's talk about the music. It's got a familiar Sting-like quality to it. Everyone will know the world that they're moving into. It seems that your love of traditional forms that you've always used and turned into a contemporary idiom is especially strong. It begins with the Northumbrian pipes, for goodness sake, on stage. I mean, that vibe, those cadences are obviously very important to you musically.
Well, you know, I was brought up in those cadences of Northumbrian folk music, very, very close to me. But also, you know, my mother's record collection was Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. Never saw a play or a musical as a kid, but we had those records. Oklahoma, Carousel, My Fair Lady, Lerner and Lowe. I loved those records and played them to death. So the play is a curious amalgam of folk music, pop music, and sort of traditional show tune. This story has always had an operatic scale, if you like. If it's not an opera, but it has the scale of an opera. I wanted to just reproduce that epic quality of what those men and women did. The work was hideous. They hated what they did, but they could look back at the end of the day and say, I helped to build that thing. And the pride in the town for those ships that they made was palpable.
This has been a journey. It's more than a decade since you first began to get to grips with the music that's on stage, although I think a lot of it is quite recent. I mean, it's quite contemporary. You've still been writing, haven't you, up to this moment?
I think there are at least three new songs in this production from the last version. So, yeah, and I'll never finish writing it.
And you know that it's never going to be perfect. It's always going to be under construction, a bit like the next ship.
A bit like life. Life is not perfect, but it's an interesting journey, and I'm so happy to be on it.
You're used to being on stage and singing and performing and letting music breathe. You're doing something different here.
Yeah.
How big a shift was that for you in your head?
One of the challenges is I'm not only acting up there, I'm also listening to the band, thinking that arrangement is not quite right and what the drummer's doing there, I can change that, and then I've got to deliver my line. So it's quite difficult to wear two hats at the same time.
And as you come off the stage, and I won't describe how it happens, but it's quite a spectacular exit, almost as spectacular as the ship being launched. In a way, you're back where you started, aren't you?
Yes. Salmon will tend to go back to the same river that he was spawned in, so I feel I've gone back.
Sting, thank you very much.
Thank you. What do you got? What do you got? You've got
notes. You've got notes. That was...
I thought you were going to join in there. That's what I was waiting for.
So into the music. I thought about joining in, then I realised that would actually not be very good for the programme. That was the great Jim Nocte reporting.
5 to 9 now. Are our attention spans so short that it's impacting the way that films are being made because we can't concentrate for long enough to actually take in a full one without help? Well, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck recently appeared on the Joe Rogan podcast, and they said things like special effects and plot scripting are changing to accommodate a world where we're so easily distracted.
Netflix, you know, standard way to make an action movie that we learned was you usually have like 3 set pieces, one in the first act, one in the second, one in the third, and they kind of ramp up in the big one with all the explosions, and you spend most of your money on that one in the third act. That's your kind of finale. And now they're like, can we get a big one in the first 5 minutes? We want people to stay tuned in. And, you know, it wouldn't be terrible if you reiterated the plot 3 or 4 times in the dialogue because people are on their phones while they're watching, you know what I mean?
That was Matt Damon. Well, Tim Robey's film critic for The Telegraph. Hannah Verdier is TV and culture journalist who's written extensively for The Sun and The Guardian and The Metro. Morning, both.
Morning.
Morning.
Tim, have we ruined it for ourselves here?
I think it might be a bit of a fork in the road, you know, because do you respect films as a great popular art form that bring people together, whether it's your family or whether it's, you know, a room full of strangers, and allow you to escape everyday reality? Or do we treat cinema as kind of like a glorified screensaver that's just on in the background while everyone doom scrolls through their social media feeds and waits for the world to end? I mean, I think I know which side of that I'm on, but I'm worried that Netflix is on the other side now.
Yeah, I suppose, Hannah, as well, to an extent, it's where you watch it. If you're in the cinema, it's I was going to say it's socially unacceptable. People still do it. You still see people pull out the phone and give it a quick check. But if you're at home, it's a very different experience.
Well, it should be illegal to pull out your phone at the cinema because it's a beautiful spectacle you're watching. But when you're at home, realistically, who isn't watching 2 or 3 screens at the same time? And also with Netflix, I find the younger generation watch subtitles just so that they can get distracted by their phone and catch up very quickly, which I think ruins it. But this is how we're consuming it now.
Yeah. I mean, there is a question, I suppose, Tim, isn't there? We do it a particular way because we've always done it a particular way. But is that the right way?
Yeah, I'm guilty of it myself. I have a pretty bad phone addiction. But I do try at home, if I'm going to stick a film on, to allow that to be a bit of a sanctuary, to put the phone in the other room or something. And I, you know, without wanting to belittle television as a medium, I understand people sticking the telly on in the background while they do all manner of things. You know, you do the ironing, you watch the TV, etc. But these films that Netflix are paying for, they're paying $100 million, $200 million for these productions. And they're just giving up if they're just saying, well, it's probably just a second priority to everyone's, you know, phones at this point. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a real shame because they should be using that money ambitiously and saying, well, let's challenge the viewer and maybe see if they can concentrate and follow the plot.
Yeah. I guess as well, Hannah, on the flip side of that, they've spent all of that money. And if people are watching it and simultaneously on social media saying how good it is, maybe that's a good thing for them, well, for their business model, at least.
It's a win-win, but I think Netflix has evolved really well to match our attention spans. And I think if you look at the Harlan Coben adaptations, you get a cliffhanger at the end of every episode to keep you there. And Netflix has been very clever knowing what it's doing there. And yes, if people are hashtagging it on social media, watching along with social media, then, you know, it's more promotion, which is what they need. And that's how they can spend the money on it. Yeah. And it is good quality as well. I don't think you lose the quality. It's just that people can use it in a different way.
Yeah, it's done differently. I find, Tim, most of the time it's me on my phone looking to see where I recognise that particular actor from. Not what they've been in, but what I specifically recognise them from. And then you start, this is it. You start looking up other things and answering your questions and then it's gone.
You go down a rabbit hole and it takes you 3 hours to watch an hour and a half film because I find myself having to rewind constantly because I've missed things. It's not great. And I get it with old films too. I'll stick on an old film and quite happily dip in and out of that. But when it's something new, I think you really ought to give it one good shot.
Pay attention.
You know, fully through. Pay